Agents, journalists and politicians used to slug it out to be the least trusted and most hated professions in the country. And they've come together today like the sort of three musketeers to warn about mansion tax. Journalists are quoting estate agents, trusting them for the time being, to attack politicians over Labour's, I don't think it's going to happen, but the housing minister has refused to rule it out because they have to refuse to rule out everything in the run-up to a budget. A levy on any properties worth over £2 million. I'd love to know what you think about this.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, a Royal Navy patrol vessel is in the Caribbean to support the response to Hurricane Melissa. The Category 5 storm is due to make landfall in Jamaica this morning and could bring catastrophic flooding and landslides. Three people have already died. Dr. Simon Boxall is an oceanographer at the University of Southampton.
You've got this combination of unbelievably strong winds. Can you imagine going down the motorway in a supercar and then putting your head out the window? And then having a metre of water dumped on you, it's going to cause devastation.
Military barracks in Inverness and East Sussex are to be used to house hundreds of asylum seekers. The use of migrant hotels was branded failed, chaotic and expensive in a report published yesterday. LBC's Fraser Knight has more.
The government had promised to end the use of hotels to house asylum seekers by 2029, but reports this morning suggest that privately, Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, has tasked the Home Office with actually ending their use within a year. And so we're back to this idea of expanding the use of military sites and porta cabins, with the Times newspaper saying that two of them will be ready to move hundreds of men into by the end of next month.
A man has been charged with the murder of a pensioner who died the day after his house was burgled. John Burke, who was 86, was assaulted during the break-in in Hackney in East London at the end of last month. 39-year-old Ashley Malcolm is due to appear in court this morning. Men with suspected prostate cancer will be able to get a diagnosis within a day as part of an NHS trial in England. Artificial intelligence will be used to read MRI scans, which will then be checked by a specialist. Health officials say it's a potential game-changer. And Brendan Rodgers has resigned as Celtic manager with immediate effect. A major shareholder had criticised Rodgers' recent comments about the strength of the squad. Former boss Martin O'Neill will take charge temporarily. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 96.57. That is up 4. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather, mostly dry with sunny spells, but showers in Scotland, Northern Ireland and parts of Northern England. A high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
How would you describe McCain vibes?
I would reckon it's like a crisp and a chip. If they had a baby, do you know what I mean?
Well, you know what?
A chip and a crisp.
Combination.
It's got crisp ancestry, but it's a chip.
Like a hot chip crisp combo thingy? Yeah? Pure poetry, that was.
McCain vibes. Our chip crisp combo hot snack thingies. In a freezer aisle near you.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 10 is the time. A very good morning to you. We've done it again, haven't we? It's so unsatisfying. It was Cassandra, wasn't it, in Greek mythology, who was cursed to be correct with her prophecies but never believed. And being proved right has, since 2016, never felt so unsatisfying. But I told you yesterday, and I must confess I've been a little bit surprised by some of the people in my profession who fell headlong into this trap. If someone says something racist, especially on the telly, you don't have a debate about whether or not it's racist. Even ITV last night is finding itself asking questions about whether this racism is actually racism or realism. And I told you it was going to happen, and I derive no pleasure whatsoever from being proved right, but given that we spend a couple of minutes catching up with each other every morning, I thought I'd just record the fact that I was very disappointed and dismayed to see some of the people wading headlong into precisely... I mean, you read a Richard Littlejohn column in the Daily Mail, you know what you're going to get, but you turn on previously or often decent broadcasting and find a debate about whether racism is actually racism, and your heart sinks a little further as the Overton window shifts a little more rightward. But we're not going to start with that today. I don't know if you've noticed this. It's a bit cocky of me to think that you might have done, to be honest. Well, I don't know how much attention you pay to my burblings every morning. You might just have me on to keep the cat company, or to keep you awake, or possibly to help you fall asleep. But I don't know. There's two types of listener, isn't there? There's the background noise, and then there's the hanging on your every word. And I suppose most of us oscillate between both of those poles and end up somewhere in between. I probably concentrate a little more on what I'm saying than you do, but not always. And there have certainly been occasions where you've pointed out that I've got the time wrong, the day wrong, the story wrong, the facts wrong, everything wrong. But generally speaking, I suspect that the team upstairs, the management team, would expect me to be paying a little bit more attention than you do to what goes on between 10 and 1 on LBC. And I have noticed in recent months, I have noticed that I'm getting interested in something I was never that interested in before. It's very strange. I'm not bad at maths. I pretend I'm bad at maths because I'm not as good at maths as I am at other stuff. But I'm like B grade, B to B plus at maths. And I have a grasp of economics, although I didn't major in it. I went to the London School of Economics, but I didn't do an economics degree, technically speaking, although I've got the letters Econ in brackets after the BSc that I have never actually attached to my name. But I've never, and I probably shouldn't admit this to you, but I suspect you may have noticed, on days when matters fiscal fall into my lap on the programme, I never get stuck into it. Budget day, which is, of course, just around the corner, has always left me curiously befuddled. If it's a Tory government, I normally come out of budget day better off than I went into it. Not always, but normally I come off better off than I went into it. Certainly in the context of income tax, until very, very recently, until Rishi Sunak, I think, I'd be better off than I was before. And I sit here feeling a little bit left out when the entire UK media starts sifting through the fine detail. Occasionally, they come up with a little nugget that I can enjoy, like the pasty tax. Do you remember when George Osborne put a tax on pasties? Or that was fun. And I still go to the pub just about often enough to notice the price of beer, although in the southeast now you need to sell a kidney to buy a round in many, many pubs. I never really smoked cigarettes, so I didn't really get engaged in the fags up, beer down kind of coverage of the budget. And then I need to get the right word so that you don't think less of me. This isn't complacency. It's not because I'm insulated from financial reality. Even when I've been on my uppers over the years, or been a lot less comfortable than we are now, I have not engaged in it. I've never felt it makes that much difference to me, you know? And I don't know quite what's changing. I don't know quite why this is changing. Is it because of the national conversation being so weird? Everybody knows Rachel Reeves has to raise money. There will probably be spending cuts in the budget as well, but the David Cameron-inspired theology that preached the notion that you could fix an international banking crisis by closing libraries in Wolverhampton has withered on the vine. Reform UK councils elected on a promise to cut spending are discovering that there is no spending left to cut. There is no fat left to trim. You might have a bugbear, you might have a favourite, you think the unemployed people get too much, or kids with ADHD get too much, or whatever it may be, but I'm not going to be rude to you. You're not necessarily an idiot, you're just wrong. You've been led by the nose into these ludicrous positions by people who work in the media, charged with one job and one job only, protecting the interests of wealth. That is what many of us do, every single day. God knows how I've managed to wriggle off that particular hook, and many mornings swim in precisely the opposite direction. But the reason why people like Mark Zuckerberg control Facebook, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, Elon Musk bought Twitter, Rupert Murdoch bought the Times and the Sun, various other sort of plutocrats and oligarchs, up to and including a former KGB officer, have made major investments in UK and US media, is to protect the interests of wealth. And the reason why that reaches your ears with a veneer of surprise or even a little bit of a sneer, you go, oh, shut up, James, you lefty idiot. The reason why it reaches your ears with that sense is because it has been so effective. And you have been so effectively groomed and gaslit into not noticing. Because why would you notice if 80% of the UK media is dedicated to protecting the interests of wealth, possibly higher if you include the infiltration of the BBC by the weird Tufton Street stink tanks dedicated to protecting the interests of wealth, you're not going to notice that it's happening. We are the frog being slowly boiled in the water until we're dead. Or in this case, brain dead. We have stopped noticing what is being done to us on a daily basis. And that's why I'm really interested in the mansion tax proposal that's in the news today, because I approach it. Listen, I think we should all be paying more income tax. And because I am in the category, as we discussed late last week or early this week, I would be paying more, much, much, much more than the average earner. Much more than the average earner. Some of those percentage thresholds that we discussed and discovered were remarkable. But remember, that's just for earnings. That's got nothing to do with money coming in, income coming in from investments, if you like, unearned income, income you get. I know there's risk involved in investments, but you don't have to put a shift in to get any of it. And the mansion tax has prompted such an extraordinary reaction across the UK media that it really reminded me that I'm also in the pot of frogs being slowly boiled. Because, you know, the idea of, I know in the southeast things are a little bit different to how they are in the rest of the world. According to Sarah Potchin, we're not terrified of black and brown faces in adverts or driven mad by them. So that's one example of a difference. I've got an update on that story for you later in the programme, which once again proves to an absolutely inarguable degree a point we made yesterday. It's not many people that are going to be affected by a mansion tax. And it's not a tax on a £2 million property. It's a tax on however much your property is worth that is more than £2 million. I don't think it's going to happen, which I know you're automatically thinking, why are we talking about it then? And the answer to that is, well, I could be wrong. And given the pearl-clutching and horror shows unfolding on the front pages of your newspapers, and no prizes for guessing which newspapers, and within your newspapers, and again, no prizing. I'll give you a clue. Newspapers owned by precise... Oh, I forgot about the Viscount, didn't I? I forgot about Viscount Rothermere. Newspapers owned by people who are already richer than Croesus, and are clearly very, very worried about mansion taxes, because apparently being richer than Croesus is still not rich enough. They have instructed their foot soldiers and their troops to come out against the mansion tax, which I still think is less likely to happen than a 1p increase on income tax. But I'm not going to say that again, because it kind of undermines the entire point of the hour that we're about to spend discussing it. Front page of the Daily Mail suddenly treats estate agents as the most reliable arbiters of truth and integrity in these islands. Labour's plan to hammer homeowners with a new mansion tax is hanging like a sword of Damocles over the housing market, experts warned last night. What experts? Who are the expert estate agents? In fact, just on the front page, one bloke from one estate agency. It's a sword of Damocles hanging over the housing market. And listen, it might be for 5 minutes, but if it happens, it happens. And the housing market will, like everything else in a capitalist economy, will adjust to the new rules and parameters. But I'm not now going to say what you're expecting me to say. And part of me doesn't know the answer to the question that you're about to ask me. Part of me doesn't know whether or not my problem with the mansion tax is because I would be required to pay it. Not much, and not definitely, actually, but probably, and not by much. And that is not an extraordinary position to find yourself in the southeast if you're, you know, middle class and you've been lucky enough not to be out of work for the last couple of decades. But there's something about this one that I don't like. And I don't know whether it is... what is it you do? You do, if you're complaining about the status quo and you're not minted, it's the politics of envy. And if you're complaining about the status quo and you are minted, oh, that's it, champagne socialism. So I can't be accused of, I don't think I can be accused of either today. Champagne socialism, if you've got a few quid and you think that the distribution of wealth in this country is unfair. Politics of envy, if you haven't got a few quid and you think the distribution of wealth in this country is unfair. But I don't like, I don't like this proposal. And I don't know that I'm going to garner much sympathy for you, from you, for the reasons why I don't like it. The first is perilously close to one of those Daily Telegraph articles about how hard it is to get by on £150,000 a year. The point is, of course, that if you're spending £151,000 a year, then the struggle is real, albeit not remotely comparable to the struggle of people trying to get by on £15,000 a year. It is technically real. Charles Dickens nailed it through the lips of Mr. Micawber, didn't he, in David Copperfield. And the second reason why I don't like it is everyone I know, or almost everyone I know, I'm cursed with some very wealthy friends. I got one or two friends who are so rich, there's no point being competitive. Unless I start buying lottery tickets, there's no earthly way that we're ever going to be on the same page financially. But most people I know, and again, this is particular to the southeast, if they live in a house worth £2.5 million, they have probably got a £1 million mortgage. So from that perspective, and unless I've misunderstood the proposal and it would take into account mortgages, and it can't really, because if it did, then you'd just go out and remortgage in order to get yourself under whatever threshold of mortgage it is that you need to not apply for the thingamajig. I don't think it actually makes sense. So I don't like it, and I'm not quite sure how self-serving that opposition is. I don't think it is, because as I say, I'm in favour of increases to income tax, which would hit me harder. But I don't like it, and I don't think it makes any sense, given that almost all of us, unless we're, you know, past retirement age, probably have a rather large mortgage on their rather large house, don't they? Don't, I mean, that's just the case, isn't it? So, what do you think of the mooted mansion tax? That's the question. 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need, because, you know, you could be earning gazillions of pounds. You could be richer than Croesus, but not necessarily minded to live in a big house. You could be quite happy living I don't know. It's something about it. I can't quite articulate. Was it the Pickwick Papers rather than David Copperfield? No, it was David Copperfield, wasn't it, Mr. Micawber? I must go back to Dickens, actually. I've got so much to look forward to in retirement. Possibly including paying a mansion tax. But I want you to tell me why you like it or why you don't like it. In a nutshell, right, any property worth more than £2 million, you will pay 1% on the figure above £2 million. So if it's £3 million, you pay 10 grand a year. And I think I said something earlier in the week about how hard it might be to find 10 grand a year if you're living in a £2 million house. And even as I said the words, I recognised how ridiculous they would sound to many, many people. As ridiculous as the Daily Telegraph articles about how hard it is to get by on £150,000 a year, especially since they've put up VAT on school fees. God damn them. But I don't like it. And I think I know why, but I can't be sure that it's not for the reasons that I would attack others. Okay? So you tell me what you think. That's the question. A tax of 1% on the value in excess of £2 million on every home in the country. 0345 6060973. Is it fair? Is what I want to know. Because I think the reason why I think it's unfair is because of all the variables. the variable of the mortgage, the variable of the geography, the location in which you live, the variable of income. You might be living in an expensive house, but you might not have much income. And yeah, you could sell it and move, but then you'd be paying stamp duty to the nth degree, and you'd end up getting rinsed of the only asset you have, even as your income has dwindled to almost nothing. On the other hand, break open the world's tiniest violins, because O'Brien is going into bat for people who own homes worth £2.5 million. And that's why I'm not entirely clear on the question of fairness. It feels unfair to me. And yet the idea of it being in any way unfair at a time of national need to go after people with the most expensive homes in the country simultaneously repels me. So I don't know if you're going to be able to help with my confusion this morning. You don't have to, but you can help with the question of fairness. Is this fair? If not, why not? And if yes, can you sound a little more sophisticated than just wanting to, I don't know, soak the rich, who, in their own estimation, despite the value of their home, probably don't actually feel that rich? This should be good. Join in on 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
At Harwoods, we know your car says a lot about you. Maybe that you like to make an entrance, or you'd rather make your escape. That you want to cut a dash, or just cut your emissions. That you like to take the bends, or bring your four-legged friends. Whatever, we speak your language. Come and have a chat at Harwoods Audi Crawley and Five Oaks and Harwoods Volvo Crawley. Details at harwoods.co.uk. Harwoods, family owned since 1931.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that dream holiday or a weekend getaway. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
And? Well, that makes there's always more of those. So live a life of ants. Live a life of...
I got tickets on pre-sale.
And?
We're in the trackside lounge!
And points on?
Adjustable desks for the new office.
And even getting rewarded on...
Lamb sheesh.
And?
A pickle.
And having a minute to you.
Cannonball!
Because with Amex, with rewards for life and business, there's always something more.
Preferred Rewards Gold Credit Card. Representative 86.3% APR variable. Annual fees apply after first year. Subject to status. 18 plus. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Rarely would the north-south gap be as wide as it is with a conversation like this, so I'm going to keep a track of the geography. A terraced house in London, in some parts of London, will be worth more than £2 million. And, of course, as Michael points out, you can't spend a house. But can you realistically, as I think I'm trying to do this morning, bang on about the unfair distribution of wealth and object to a tax on the biggest asset that most of us will ever have? Vivian is in Islington. Vivian, what would you like to say?
Oh, hello, James. Big fan of yours. Okay. I'm indeed a Labour voter, yes. But this has kind of thrown me a bit. Yeah, my house is worth over £2 million because it's in Islington. And I moved in over 40 years ago when it was quite, you know, relatively cheaper,
yes.
Much cheaper. And I live on a pension, as does my husband. We're both, he's 80, yeah. I'm nearly 80, and we've got teachers' pensions. And quite honestly, the problem with this is we couldn't really, you know, to work out another, I don't know, what, 1% on over, well, it might be a bit more than that. So it could be, I don't know, a few thousand quid a year.
Yeah.
To in order to stay in our own home seems desperately unfair somehow. Yes, I could move, But if I want to stay in the area that has become my home, it would still cost me a fortune, and by the time I've paid stamp duty, etc., I would be out of pocket. I can't. So I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. I mean, I did wonder whether I'd just say, no, I'm not going to pay because I can't afford it. Send me to jail.
And they'll cart you off to jail, and you'd become the Islington One, Vivian. Free the Islington One. I'd be there with my placard, although they'd probably outlaw that by tea time, wouldn't they?
I mean, I'm all for the distribution of wealth, you know. I'm all for the broader shoulders.
Yes.
I just didn't realise it was going to be my shoulders.
And a home, I don't know why. There's a difference between a home and a house, isn't there, in this conversation? But a home doesn't feel like an asset, even though it's the biggest asset most of us would ever have, in the same way that, for example, a share portfolio or, a cellar full of gold bullion feels like an asset. A home feels like a necessity.
Yes, of course, and it is your home. And the idea that you're being kind of forced to, you know, think of, well, you've got to give it up then. Yeah, sure, if I needed care and all of this, it would have to go. And if I die while I'm still here, then, it's going to, my inheritors will get it. But they will pay 40% over quite a lot. So, they are going to have to whack out as well. So I do understand, all for inheritance tax, that's fine. But I wouldn't even mind that going up a bit. But not the idea that somebody like me, and I'm sure there's plenty of us, in Camden, in Islington, various parts of London, who are on pensions and who think, well, how am I going to pay? I once wrote to Emily Thornberry about it, who is my local MP, and she said, well, you just have to not pay it, and then the interest will accrue, so by the time you die, it'll all come out of your estate.
So you'd owe a lot. And
I owe an awful lot of money, which again, it kind of feels a bit,
And also, it depends how long you live, and you're going to be every tick of the clock. If you have heirs and heiresses, you're going to feel that they're having their pocket picked every time you manage to clock another year up.
They'll really want me to die, won't they?
No, of course they won't, Vivian, but some of us may sort of allow ourselves to feel that way. And yet you recognise, I think, it's not quite an anomaly, is it? But there's an odd feeling about defending. As we accept the necessity of tax rises, as I think almost everybody does, particularly people who've managed to cut through the media dedicated to preserving the interests of the very, very, very richest people in the country. £2 million to somebody in, let me just glance at my screen, £2 million to somebody in Runcorn sounds like an extraordinary amount of money.
I mean, and if I lived, and I'd feel that too, but in a sense, it's saying, well, you made the mistake. You moved into an area that then became, because of the deregulation of the city, Islington took off.
Of course.
And you're saying, well, hard luck. You made the mistake. And so it's like, make another life. I mean, if I'd made a life somewhere else, fine. But I've made my life here.
I don't think you should be hit with this. And you're retired as well, so you're not going to be affected by income tax rises particularly. But I think those of us who are earning the most should be the ones who pay the most. And everybody should be earning over a certain threshold, should put a little bit more shoulder to the wheel to get us out of the mess that various things, chiefly the Tories, have left us in. And you've nailed the unfairness. Thank you, Vivian, for coming in so clearly and so concisely on that simple question of fairness. I don't know who listening to this will start shouting at the radio, shouting at Vivian, remember, not some sort of faceless person, shouting at two retired teachers living in a house that has ended up being worth an eye-watering sum of money, but has absolutely nothing to do with any decisions they've ever made beyond wanting to be near the schools where they worked 40 years ago, and you'd be hitting them with a tax of, what, £5,000 to £10,000 a year, which they simply haven't got. So, first witness for the defence, completely unfair. Andrew is also in Islington. I don't want to, I mean, goodness knows I'm a walking cliche, Andrew, but if I manage to do a radio phone-in show consisting entirely of contributions from Islington, then I think that really will put the cherry on the icing of the cake of the cliche. What would you like to say?
This is just a complete coincidence. We are now the Islington Two. I share your misgiving. I think everything you said in your introduction, and also what Vivian has just said. I mean, I think it's weird that you tax an asset, the value of which can vary hugely, and it doesn't mean you have the money. You know, if somebody living in a £2 million house does not have £2 million...
Let's say two and a half, just because if it's a £2 million house, you won't pay anything.
But it doesn't mean they have... It doesn't make them rich. And, I mean, a consequence of this is you could... You know, what happens if you go... You say, OK, I'll use my money to buy an expensive painting.
Yes.
But anyway, my point is that no one seems to have raised so far about this tax is... So you live in a house which is valued... By the way, the importance of estate agents is they are probably the people who are going to do the valuation. I mean, God knows how much this program would cost just to get it going.
Yeah.
Anyway, the estate agents value your house at £3 million. You pay the tax for 5 years on the basis of that. Then when you come to sell it, there's a glut. And you suddenly find your house is worth £1.5 million. You've been paying tax...
Or 1.9.
For 5 years on an asset that you... Okay,
that no longer exists.
That never existed because it was all illusory anyway, which is the point of when you tax somebody based on the value of something, you're taxing it on a vagary.
Okay,
you know?
I think I can come back on this, and I've been very honest this morning. I don't know whether I'm being the devil's advocate or not today. It's a weird one for me. Happy to pay more income tax, troubled by this one for reasons that you and Vivian have articulated. But let's say your house is worth £2.5 million. You pay £5,000 a year on it for 5 years. That's £25,000. Well, you sell your house for £1.9 million. You're not going to notice it.
Why not?
Well, £25,000 out of £1.9 million, just in simple percentage terms, is pretty close to a drop in the ocean.
Well, with respect, I think that's a slightly odd argument. The argument is that because it's not very much, it's justifiable. I mean,
I mean, I said I wasn't sure whether I was being the devil's advocate or not. I saw an argument. I saw an argument, so
yeah,
I articulated
you,
it.
You know, see any argument and I'll bolt for it.
That's me. Today it is. It's not normally, but there's some mileage in it, isn't there? Or do you think it's a completely ridiculous observation?
I don't think it's a ridiculous observation. I just don't think it's workable. I mean, I think it's... You maybe get a lawyer on. I think it's possible this could be challenged if that ever happened.
Yeah, that's...
Somebody could say, I've been paying tax for 5 years on something I never had. Can I have my money back?
Can I have it back, please? Well, I said it. I mean, that was going to be the phone-in originally, was whether it was feasible or fair. I should have done both, shouldn't I? So you think it's unfair, but perhaps more importantly, you think it's unfeasible.
I do.
I see why.
The whole value of every single house now, because you've got to value, in theory and probably in practice, you've got to evaluate every single house in case someone's getting away with it, in quotes. So every single house in the country is going to have a value.
And what does it go on? Does it go? I mean, it can't go on the last price that was paid for it, because Vivian bought her house 40 years ago. She'd be home free. She probably paid £5,000 for it.
And as I said, you know, coming back to my point, during the duration of while you're paying it, that value will vary. And it could go down as well as up.
Well, you mentioned lawyers, and they are always welcome on this programme, with the caveat, of course, that it's, their contributions will be for free. I also, this thing we don't do enough, that I always think we should do more and then forget about, is international comparisons. Does it work in any other countries? Andrew, thank you. I'm just going to have a quick word with the producer, all right? You talk among yourselves. Can we make sure the next caller is not from Islington, unless they're called Kia? All right? Are we clear? Good. Thomas Watts has your headlines.
Jamaica's strongest storm on record, the Category 5 Hurricane Melissa, is approaching the island. It's due to make landfall this morning and could bring catastrophic flooding and landslides. A defence minister has told LBC that further MOD sites are being identified to replace asylum hotels. The Home Office has confirmed two barracks in Inverness and in East Sussex will be used to house about 900 men. The NHS in England is to trial a new technology which can give a prostate cancer diagnosis within a day. It uses AI to interpret MRI scans for men suspected of having the disease. And in the last few minutes, it's been announced the actress Prunella Scales has died at the age of 93. LBC weather, mostly dry with sunny spells for many, showers in Scotland, Northern Ireland and parts of Northern England. A high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m.
I have found completely shocking the extent of the anti-Semitism that people have felt because of what's been going on in the Middle East, emboldened not just to criticise the Israeli government, but to use what is happening in the Middle East as a way of allowing you to expose what you really believe. And I think a lot of people have shown themselves for what they really are.
Tom Swarbrick with cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses. LBC.
At Harwoods, we know your car says a lot about you. Maybe that you like to make an entrance, or you'd rather make your escape. That you want to cut a dash, or just cut your emissions. That you like to take the bends, or bring your four-legged friends. Whatever, we speak your language. Come and have a chat at Harwood's Audi Crawley and Five Oaks and Harwood's Volvo Crawley. Details at harwoods.co.uk. Harwood's, family owned since 1931.
Right, flight's booked, hotel sorted, roll on summer. Are we driving to the airport?
No thanks, I'm going with Stan.
Who's Stan?
Stansted Express, silly. Tickets are from just £9.90 one way if we book in advance, and it only takes 48 minutes from London.
Awesome. Oh, had me worried then.
Yeah, I used them when I went to see Pedro.
Oh, yeah. Wait, what?
Stansted Express. It's faster by train. Average journey time of 48 minutes between London Liverpool Street and Stansted Airport. T's and C's apply.
At Pets in a Pickle, we know your furry friends get up to all kinds of mischief. Like when the dog scuffed that entire chocolate cake. All the time the cat tested his nine lives from the curtain rail. Again. That's why we're here when it matters most, with fuss-free pet insurance policies, including unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 10:34, and I never know which passings of famous people will resonate and which ones won't. I mean, I'm like you sometimes. If I was on holiday when somebody of a certain age died, I sometimes struggle to remember whether they're dead or alive. But I suspect that, like me, you will feel a peculiar sadness about the passing of Prunella Scales, one of those people who sort of just assumed a place of permanence in the national consciousness, not just because of the second act of her career, playing most famously Sybil Fawlty, but because of the fourth or fifth act of her professional life, when she took to touring the country in canal boats with her husband Timothy West, and they have spoken about her dealings with dementia. And some celebrity families, you feel like you know them, don't you? It's quite weird for two kind of old school actors to have achieved that place in the national affections, but for me at least, those two did. I saw a little weird thing on social media today. I'm very blessed to have a long and happy marriage, and I think the longer and happier it becomes, the more dewy-eyed I get about seeing other examples of that kind of thing, because God knows we're lucky. There aren't many of them left anymore, are there? I saw a photograph this morning of some sea otters. Please don't at me if this isn't true. Okay, I don't want to know, because I want this to be true. And if it's not true, then, like a Brexit voter, I want you to leave me alone in my delusion, unchallenged and unmolested, all right? I saw a thing today on Instagram that told me that sea otters hold on to each other while they're asleep in the sea so that they don't float away. And I don't know why I thought of that when I read about Prunella Scales. I just heard about Prunella Scales passing. But the dedication and devotion that her husband, Timothy West, has shown to her through her illness is off the charts. And I don't even know the guy, but I feel that I should offer my condolences to their son, Sam, who is clearly, for an actor, an incredibly well-adjusted young man as a direct consequence of having two such extraordinary and magnificent parents. I remember in Hobson's Choice as well, one of my all-time faves, actually. But there it is, and we'll play the obligatory clip shortly. And again, I don't know why, because you get cross with me sometimes. You say, "Why didn't you talk about so and so's passing?" But this is me. This is me who sits with you every morning, and I've got enthusiasms, and sometimes they don't reflect the national mood, and sometimes they do. So on this one, oh dear. Oh, so there we go. Prunella Scales. God bless. And rest in peace. 10:37 is the time. The next caller is Keir in Islington. Keir, what made you... I'm only joking. It's Andrew in Bishop Stortford. Andrew, what would you like to say?
Hi there. I don't know whether... The last couple of callers actually did really well. I think they covered the kind of the unfairness aspect in the respect that, you know, it's kind of like... Okay, I'm not in the position of owning a sort of £2 million house or anything, but...
Oh, but that's really relevant, because the last two were And a couple of people have pointed out, we all four of us so far on the programme have had similar accents. And I don't know whether or not that is relevant to the conversation that we're having, but at least three texters think that it is.
Right, right. I mean, you know, it just, the reason I think it's a little unfair is, I mean, you are kind of pulling the rug from underneath people, aren't you? As we know, you know, so for example, you know, a close relative of mine does own a sort of £2 million house. And I mean, I know they work hard, they've got a small business, or a small to medium kind of sized business, they put everything into it, you know, but they also have like a sort of £750,000 mortgage. You know, so yes. They don't own the £2 million.
That's the bit I don't get. I mean,
I don't get it either.
The mathematics of it. And of course, if you say, well, we won't go after the mortgage bit, then I'm going to remortgage.
Yeah, so I think the unfairness is the pulling the rug from under, and then the unfeasible aspect. It's just unfeasible. Unless somehow Labour's got data that says we have lots of people that have £2 million, £2.5 million houses, and they have lots of cash in the bank. Let's take some of that. You know, just, otherwise you're taxing their income. You know, their actual, not their wealth, but their income, aren't you?
Yes.
You know, or the fact that, you know, you're taxing something that they don't really have.
But I have an inkling. I mean, there's a threshold here that is going to be incredibly subjective and personal. Because if you're living in a £20 million house, there is a little bit of me that thinks you should, especially given how ludicrous council tax boundaries are, there is a little bit of me that thinks you probably should be paying a sort of a property premium every year for the, I don't know, for the what? The privilege? If you're in a £20 million house and you're relying on a mortgage, then you're probably not very good at economic management. If you're in a £2 million house and you couldn't buy it without a mortgage, then yes, you are deserving of sympathy in this situation, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess that's right. I mean,
supporters. We've had a. Are you? Forgive me for asking this. It's a terribly rude inquiry. But are you on the hook for some of the money of the when your relative's £2 million house is sold? Are you?
No, it's not that. It's not like my parents or anything
like
that.
Spinster aunt. Not an aged P.
It's a sibling, so it's like...
No, fair enough. I mean, I know, obviously, I live in the South East. I know a lot of people who live in houses worth more than £2 million, almost all of whom, except the ones who have lost a parent and inherited enough money to pay off their mortgage, will be relying on mortgages, which just makes it sound weird. And you know what I do now? Thank you, Andrew. So we've had two Islingtons and two Andrews today. I don't know what's up next. I think I've got a Reuben in Liverpool. That should put a cat among the pigeons. You know what I do now? I think if we've identified a really obvious flaw in something, such as my, I don't know what you'd call it, imposter syndrome, I think we must be making a mistake. If this flaw is so big and so obvious, how could clever people running countries not have noticed it? Don't at me to challenge the description of governments as clever people running countries. And what we haven't had is international comparisons. And then the problem is, you know, raise it to £5 million and then everyone would be okay. Because if you're in a £5 million house and you couldn't buy it without a mortgage, that just seems a little bit weird to the rest of us. But it probably wouldn't raise much money. Reuben is, as promised, in Liverpool. Reuben, what would you like to say?
I'm in Liverpool, James. Well, I'm afraid I moved here from the South East.
Not from Islington.
No,
thank goodness for that. Thank goodness for that.
I haven't picked up a Scouse accent yet. But,
carry on.
So I just think I've got possibly a bit of a silver bullet to the problems that you're having with it, which is that, in my opinion, I don't know if there's any idea to do this, but if you were to base the policy on the most recent sale price of the house, not on a current valuation, not trying to get real estate agents to value it or something, but on the most recent sale price, then surely anyone who's been able to recently purchase a house for over £2 million can afford to pay this tax, whereas obviously people who've been living there 40 years and it's hypothetically
What if they bought it before Liz Truss had blew up their mortgage payments and now they're struggling to meet them?
Well, I mean, you're going to have to look at individual cases, but are you saying that someone's in a £2.5 million house struggling to make mortgage payments and not thinking of selling that house anyway?
Yeah, but selling it for less than they paid, perhaps, in the current climate, which means everyone's a loser except them.
If they sell it for less than £2 million, then it wouldn't apply, would it?
Well, they'd get capital gains tax, which... No, they wouldn't on their primary residence, would they? This doesn't make sense.
If someone owns a second house, then obviously you should be taxing that as well, because...
Absolutely
no
agree.
No,
I've got no problem with that, but you're giving a huge... I mean, what about people who've always been minted? People who bought a £1 million house 30 years ago, and they're still among the richest people in the country, and their house is now worth £5 million. They're off the hook completely. That's insane.
Until they sell it, potentially, yes, but...
So you're going to bring in a form of capital gains tax on primary residences.
Well, the fact is we need to tax the wealthiest people in this country. We need ways to do it.
Yeah.
Currently, there's too many loopholes. There's too many ways around every single tax.
But inheritance tax already does what you're. Inheritance tax already does what you're describing.
Exactly. So why can't you apply the same thing to this tax?
It is applied to this. You mean they're already paying inheritance tax if their house is worth that much?
Right, but this is just another way of, as you've already said...
So you're just describing it, essentially...
You need to raise money. This is a separate tax that you pay whilst you're alive.
No, I know all this.
If your house...
But what you're suggesting is just a big increase in inheritance tax.
Is it? I mean, I...
With a threshold, so...
Paying every year whilst you're alive. You just wouldn't pay it if you're the lady who's been living in Islington for 40 years and only...
I think it would translate effectively as a big increase in inheritance tax that doesn't recognise the...
On the wealthiest people in the country, on people who...
Not necessarily. The owners and mortgagees of the most expensive houses in the country, not necessarily the highest earners or the wealthiest or any of those things, particularly depending on the size of the mortgage. And you also overlook the possibility that the price of it will come down. So it could be worth 2.3 million today, but by the time you come to sell it, it's worth 1.9, and you're on the hook for 2.3 million pounds worth of enhanced inheritance tax. I have less of a problem with inheritance tax than I do with this, and I'm not sure I could tell you why. But what you're describing is a tax on the estate that you leave behind. So, however you dice it, it's just going to be another form of inheritance tax, which is, again, a defensible position and perhaps a more feasible policy. But that leads us back to the first of the two Fs, which, would that actually be fair? I don't know, is the short answer. Reuben, thank you. 10:45 is the time.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m.
A prime example of a British farce. This man with an avocado tote bag being released from prison accidentally before being asked by the police if he doesn't mind handing himself into them. Part of the problem of lots of different elements, the public sector in particular, it is so hard to get genuine accountability for errors akin to this.
Tom Swarbrick with cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses. LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prep for the media business. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Atina, a media business student in year 12.
Being a young creative at Global Academy means that I get to turn my passion into a career. From studying creative enterprise, I've already learnt how to market my own business and gain knowledge about the business side of the industry.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Yep, I'm still dancing. And there's still time to get in tonight's EuroMillions draw. So turn up that dial. The EuroMillions jackpot is £54 million. Go on, play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
At Lathwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at Lathwaites.co.uk. Lathwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
Train to Chichester. Flasks filled, snacks packed, all ready for Maisie's first stargazing adventure.
Come on, Maisie. Follow everyone up to the top of that hill.
Oh, look. That one's the plough.
Shooting star! Wow!
Made it. Last train back and feeling cosmic. And it seems we have an astronaut in the making. Download the Southern Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
61 years of marriage. Isn't that magnificent? Absolutely extraordinary. And later in their lives, Sir Timothy West and Prunella Scales almost became as well known or better known for their romance, their life together, partly because of the shows they did on the canal boats than they had been for their acting. If you're just joining us, Prunella Scales has passed away just under a year, of course, after her husband. And it is one of those, is it linked to age? It's linked to cultural enthusiasm. And it must also be linked to the fact that this programme from which I'm about to play a fairly long clip, as it seems appropriate, is still one of the most fondly regarded and highly rated comedy programmes in the history of television.
Hi, Mia. Just checking the doors.
All right, what's going on?
I was in the bathroom.
Yes, she was, dear. So I just popped in to have a look at these hinges, you know, the ones we've been...
Do you really imagine, even in your dreams, that a girl like this could possibly be interested in an aging brilliantine stick insect like you?
Basil, seriously, Sybil, do you remember when we were first manacled together? We used to laugh quite a lot.
Yes, but not at the same time, Basil.
Do you not seem to realise that I'm needed at the hotel?
No, you're not. It's running beautifully without you.
Polly cannot cope!
Well, she can't fall over waiters or get herself jammed under desks or start burglar alarms or lock people in burning rooms or fire extinguishers straight in her own face. But I should think the hotel can do without her sort of coping for a couple of days. What do you think, Basil?
No. She was the one he had with him the third time. The first one was the dowdy one, then his wife, then her, and now this red. Oh, yes, that must have been lovely. Number 12.
Yeah. Oh, what? Hello, dear.
What are you doing?
I'm kissing you, dear.
Well, don't. Audrey, any news? Oh, dear, he hasn't. Oh, I know. He doesn't deserve you, Audrey. He really doesn't. Exactly. I know you have. I know. Oh, I know.
Are you going to go like that all night?
What was that, Audrey? Oh, I know.
A selection there of Prunella Scales playing Sybil Fawlty, originally broadcast on BBC Two in 1975. Just 12 episodes of it, if memory serves, and yet... it occupies a part of the cultural framework. It's very hard to think of any other shows that do. Originally broadcast, apparently, I have to say, in 1975 and 1979, in case you were wondering. 10:51 is the time. Christian is in Leon C to steer us back to the mansion tax. Christian, what would you like to say?
Oh, good morning, James.
Hello.
I'm trying to compose myself before hearing, several times. But, I wanted to just get my point across, which I've just been on a golf holiday with a few friends.
Yeah.
And this came up. It wasn't exactly mansion tax. My friend Ben, he was saying about property tax. Mm. He said, the government are going to bring in this property tax. That means you'll no longer be paying your council tax, whatever it is, $1,500, $2,000, but you're going to be paying $8,000 in property tax. Mm. And I thought, I've not heard that. Yeah, I heard that they're looking at property taxes and other taxes. But he was very, that's what's happening. And I channeled you, in fact. I was kind of right flying the flag for the show and sort of saying, well, hang on a sec, where'd you get your sources from? And he was saying, I've read it, he's a trader. He works, he's an intelligent guy, works in London, worked there all his working life. And, he's I read Bloomberg, I read all this. And I said, but, I listen to it. I've got my fingers across the news, but I've not heard it. So, eventually it came down to, it was a think tank called Out outreach or outseeing you. It was a Tom Tugendhat and several others. But,
okay. You know, so they've said this would be a good idea. The government should do this. And that
they've said, you know, this is going to impact everyone. And, you know, it's a little old lady.
It's possible that you're leading me to richer pickings. But I feel I should remind you what we're talking about on the show today.
Absolutely, yeah.
If so, that's all right. Because it is a specific suggestion that they're going to stick a 1% levy on the value of every home worth over the amount over 2 million for everybody. There are mutterings about, it's the centre-right think tank Onward, I think, which is said to be influencing the Treasury's thinking. And they'd be looking at a tax payable by buyers of homes over £500,000 threshold. But I don't think, and with respect to Ben, I don't think anybody is seeing that as a replacement for the council tax. That would be a second policy that would perhaps be a bit like Northern Ireland's domestic rate system. So anyway, back to the mansion tax, if I may.
So, there are parallels, obviously. The mansion tax, you know, they've got to find the money from somewhere.
Yes.
Okay, and this isn't going to solve everything.
Is it fair and is it feasible?
I think it's fair, yes. I think I do.
Would you be on the hook for it?
I wouldn't.
Fair enough. Doesn't mean it's not a valid view, just that it seems pertinent at the time.
I know people who would be, and, you know, Ben could be in that bracket himself. But
sure.
Yeah, and his view was, well, I've worked hard for this, and I've worked, and my view was, well,
We've all worked hard for all the tax we pay. Exactly. Here's the thing. Here's the breaker for me. What if Ben has got a £1 million mortgage on his £2.5 million house, and he's going to be hit with £5,000 a year of extra payments that he can't put into his mortgage? He has to put it into the Treasury's pockets. How is that fair?
I think you need to, and this was again in the argument that we were having. I say, no, a government's not just going to come in and say, right, okay, this proportion, large proportion, or fairly large proportion of the voting public are going to end up with a 10,000-20,000 bill because they'll become unelectable. So they will.
That is really it, because I don't know that they will. I think that's why I opened the show today by talking about the huge swathes of the media dedicated to the protection of wealth. Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph, trying to create an idea at the moment. Everybody's going to move to Dubai, or everybody's going to leave the country, and that private schools are going to wither on the vine and suddenly disappear, and that the mansion tax is going to kill the property market stone dead. By using people like Ben and me as ammunition, if you like, to say these poor people are going to be hit and hurt and this and that, whereas what they're really doing is contemplating the possibility of having to pay 1% of their £20 million house every year being worth over to so 1% of £18 million a year. It's themselves that they're actually trying to protect, so they're never going to vote Labour. The question of whether or not people like me or Vivian in Islington or Andrew in the Angel, people like that, are going to have their votes swayed by being required to find this money is a very different proposition instead. Indeed. Christian, thank you. I'm cracking on just because I want to get a couple of more calls in, but thank you for flying the flag for the show in the face of scepticism and misinformation. Zach's in Camberwell. Zach, what would you like to say?
Hi, I'm 25, and I guess I wanted to put forward a kind of,
good,
like, maybe how young people see some of this stuff.
Yes.
So from our perspective, like, we're the first generation, a lot of people say, to be poorer than our parents, or to expect to possibly be poorer than our parents. Yeah. And I think wealth inequality has a lot to do with that. Like, if you think about the story for our generation, we've grown up under austerity. We've got a massive climate crisis. Affordable housing seems really out of reach. You know, I personally pay £1,000 a month before bills on a one room in a flat that has a lot of problems with it.
Yeah.
It's really hard to save. And then you look at, like, the wealth inequality that's grown over the course of my lifetime. Billionaire wealth up 1,000% since 1990. 50 families own as much wealth as half the population. So I actually think with a policy like a mansion tax, you know, I'm not necessarily against people who own very high value properties being taxed, but
sure,
it feels to me like something like a wealth tax on people with 10 million plus, equalizing capital gains tax rates, with income tax rates. I mean, the example that I just can't get out of my head is Rishi Sunak. He's as rich as the king. And in 2022, he paid an effective tax rate that's equivalent to a nurse because of the way we undertax wealth in this country. And I guess I feel like with this government, why, you know, a mansion tax, you know, there's a conversation to be had, but why aren't we going after...
But it's the wrong conversation. It's the wrong conversation. I completely agree with you, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, two things can be true at the same time. You could mount a defence of the mansion tax while also going after the plutocrats and oligarchs that you describe, who, of course, coincidentally happen to own almost all of the means of dissemination now, not just traditional media, but also latterly social media. It's an astonishing coincidence that they just have a hobby of wanting to control the lines of communication while protecting their own epic and increasingly obscene interests.
And can I just mention one person in particular who I think is really interesting here, is someone like Nick Candy, who's a property billionaire, who's donated a huge amount of money to Reform UK, and guess what? He's become the treasurer of that party supposedly of the working class, that they like to tell us. But actually, they're funded by billionaires. They talk about fundraising on yachts in tax havens around the world. And
nice. Now, why might that be?
Yeah, exactly. I just think it's outrageous that they claim to be the future of this country and representing the working class, when actually...
Well, if you are, I mean, it's a nice observation, because if you are dedicated exclusively to protecting the interests of epic and obscene wealth, then the Tories, for the time being, are no good to you at all, because they have absolutely no appearance of being likely to return to power anytime soon. So if you were part of that, which is why I expect the Daily Mail to come out for Farage soon. I mean, it hasn't explicitly yet. But if you are entirely, and in fact, press record on this, not you, Zach, because you already know it, but press record on this. If you are entirely and exclusively dedicated to protecting the interests of epic and obscene wealth, then you will be throwing your weight behind a party that pretends to represent the working class. I think it's almost inevitable. And that's a great example that you provide us with. And just to correct you, I think Sunak might be richer than the king.
It's fluctuating. They're kind of in competition. But regardless, he should be paying more than a nurse. And, you know,
in percentage terms. You're absolutely right. And I'll get a message now of someone reminding us of something we talked about last week, that the top 1% of earners of income tax, and it's never quite as simple as this simplistic breakdown allows, pay 30% of the total income tax or earning-based tax take. And some people think that's proof that they do more. Because I'm very much in that 1%. That we do more, we already do more. Of course, it reaches almost everybody else's ears, unless they've been polluted by the media bias that we have been discussing this morning. It reaches almost everybody else's ears as proof that huge swathes of the country are not paid anywhere near enough, when the people who have seen their wealth increase exponentially in the period of time that Zach describes, especially during COVID, actually, if you went into COVID a billionaire, you came out probably a multi-billionaire. That statistic about income tax is proof that the wage distribution is wrong. It's not proof that people like me pay too much tax, but hey-ho, you can explain it to people. You can't understand it for them. It's 1 minute after 11.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, British tourists in Jamaica have been told to prepare as Hurricane Melissa bears down on the island. The Category 5 storm is expected to bring 4-metre waves and winds of up to 175 miles per hour when it makes landfall. It's understood there are about 8,000 British nationals there. Andrew Tracy is stranded in Jamaica after his flight back to the UK was cancelled.
We have to remain here at the hotel. They have extended our accommodation, but we are on lockdown at the hotel currently. So we have to stay in our room, and room service will bring around food packs, quite rationed food packs, but we are still getting food and drink.
A defence minister has told LBC that the MOD will step up to provide accommodation for asylum seekers. The Home Office is making preparations to use barracks in Scotland and southern England to house about 900 men. It's reported Keir Starmer has set an internal goal of closing migrant hotels within a year. The government is expected to begin a new assessment of the rules on headlights. A new survey suggests 82% of drivers are concerned about being dazzled. The RAC says it's the result of brighter, modern LED or bi xenon bulbs, poor alignment and the prevalence of SUVs. Amazon has confirmed it's reducing its corporate workforce by about 14,000. The mass redundancies are part of efforts to step up the use of artificial intelligence. The actress Prunella Scales, best known for playing Sybil in Fawlty Towers, has died. She was 93. LBC's Tom Harrigan looks back at her life.
Prunella Scales started working life behind the scenes in theatre, but she wanted to act and became a household name when John Cleese cast her as his on-screen wife, the headstrong, quick-witted hotel manager Sybil in Fawlty Towers.
Shall I deal with this, Basil?
I'm dealing with it, dear.
No, dear, that's all right. Now you wanted two singles.
I said I'd deal with it. I was here first.
Well, it's my turn now, then.
The show became one of the most loved comedies of all time. There were countless other appearances in TV dramas and films, a long-running stint in 90s supermarket adverts, and several series of great canal journeys with husband Timothy West, the couple widely praised for talking so openly about her vascular dementia.
In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading up 4 points at 96.57. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 14. LBC weather staying mostly dry with sunny spells, but showers developing in Scotland, Northern Ireland and parts of Northern England. A high of 14 Celsius. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Oh, hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 11, 55% in the reports of nurses getting racially abused at work, including by colleagues. That was a heartbreaking element of that report yesterday. Today we had carers, foster children and social workers to the list. The chief executive of the Nationwide Association of Fostering Providers reports unprecedented racism being faced by, well, I mean, it's in the headline, social workers, but also foster carers whose ethnicity differs from the children they care for. I don't know how much of this you trace back to Twitter or people like Sarah Poachin, who, of course, Nigel Farage yesterday pretended hadn't been racist when she was obviously racist, and ITV last night dedicated an actual debate to whether or not racism was racism. But there was a story a while ago when some of the racists on Twitter, including some of the infamous ones, I saw footage of a man playing with his partner's grandchildren, so playing with his step-grandchildren in the park, and they sought to portray it as being dodgy or wrong or questionable. You look at stuff like that, you think, what's going on there? Go, sorry, the man was black and his partner was white, and the grandchildren were from a previous marriage to a white man. So, you know, now we live in a country where presumably that kind of thing drives Sarah Poachin mad as well, seeing a black man playing with white children. We may get onto a different, slightly different story in the next hour about how all men now are potentially fearful of stepping in to help other children, particularly little boys, because of this sense we have that sex offenders are everywhere. And part of the reason why we have, well, I don't know if that's true, but the conversation I want to have next is actually about the, I really like this as a conversation for us to have together. I don't like it as a policy. And the reason why I don't like it as a policy is that I don't think it will make any difference to anybody. The government has identified two army training camps, one of which I don't think has any permanent residents in it, and one of which has a tiny amount. They're sort of transit camps where, and this stuff is very easy to find out. So the decision not to find this stuff out is deliberate. I think that's really important. If you're doing a job like this and you're having a conversation about these camps where people who've come over on small boats are going to be accommodated, and you haven't taken the time to find out whether that involves moving anybody out, or certainly if someone tells you that it involves moving people out and you don't bother to find out whether or not that's true, then you are scaremongering. You are making frightened people more frightened. You are making angry people angrier. As far as I can tell, the two camps that have been mentioned in the story so far are currently transit camps, where in one there are no permanent residents, as it were, there are no posted troops, and in the other there are very, very few. And I mention that because it shouldn't really matter, should it? The idea that they're going to make soldiers sleep in tents while people waiting to have their asylum applications processed live in the fairly unacceptable or unsalubrious circumstances that we expect our servicemen and women to stay in shouldn't matter. But it does, because I have a feeling that none of this matters. You know, Keir Starmer could announce that he was housing asylum seekers in cardboard boxes under Charing Cross Bridge, and the usual suspects would complain about not having any cardboard boxes themselves, or we should be reserving cardboard boxes for our own. I don't like this analysis, and I want it to be wrong, but I really don't think it is. What we don't know in this country is the difference between people who are going to complain about asylum seekers being put in a cardboard box and people who are not, people who are going to say, do you know what, actually, that's going to save a ton of money. Obviously, on an international scale, we have to do our duty. We have to do our bit when it comes to asylum. We don't do more per capita than other comparable countries. I was reading yesterday about the 2.5 million refugees that have made their way into the Kingdom of Jordan, for example, of Palestinian origin. We don't, and France and Germany and all the other comparable European countries do not do more than we do, despite lots of claims that they do, that we do more, going always unchallenged. But I don't know that it makes any difference. It will save a ton of money because people have been making millions and billions, gazillions of pounds from owning these sites. Do you remember when I said to you about 3 years ago? No, it was about 18 months ago. When this started gathering pace, because it all happened under the Tories, but the right-wing media only gets cross about it when Labour are in power, having inherited it. And I said to you, the people I'm really interested in are the people who own the facilities. You know, you own a failing hotel that isn't even washing its face as a three-star or a four-star venue. So you close it down, you stop taking proper guests, you hand it over to the government to house asylum seekers, and suddenly you're making way, way, way more money than you did when it was an actual three-star or four-star hotel, which it isn't anymore, by the way, despite, again, the unchallenged claims by various people that it is. And I don't think it matters. This is the conversation that I want to have, right? And I really want your help with it. So in Downing Street, they are embarked upon a course. I've got to get this right. It's so much for the politics of decent people now depends upon how many of those who are flirting with the nativist bile of reform are actually decent people who have been gaslit or groomed into thinking that all of their problems are the fault of 10, 50, 100,000 people coming into the country on dinghies. You never see reports about the real scale of immigration and the massive cuts in it, which I don't think are going to be very good for our economy, but if all you care about is the numbers, the net migration numbers, then, you know, not only did Brexit make everything worse, and you probably voted for that, but also things are now plummeting. That's not even an exaggeration. The overall figures are plummeting for a variety of reasons. But it's not that that people have been persuaded to care most about. It is the so-called small boats. Even in Caerphilly, I heard a candidate, the victorious candidate, I think, saying that he would have people shouting support at him in the street, and then he said, but some people were shouting stop the boats. Next to no immigration, no asylum seekers in that constituency, but none of that matters. It's emotional. That's how the far right always works. It's how racists work. It's what racism is. It's not a rational or an intellectual position. It's emotional. So in a rational country, you'd get cross with people who were making millions of pounds from providing substandard accommodation for largely desperate people. In an irrational, increasingly racist country, you get cross with everybody being housed in that accommodation because a tiny proportion of them, as with almost any other section of society, turn out to be scumbags or perverts or criminals or all three of those things. So we're going to attack everybody because of the actions of one person. The culmination of which, for now, of course, was the Farage riots after the dreadful, dreadful, hideous events in Southport. Labour have halved net migration in about a year. Nobody cares, nobody knows, because this isn't really about facts and figures. It's about feelings and fury. And Keir Starmer and his close advisers seem to me to think that it is about facts and figures. And that's why this policy has come in today. The idea that asylum seekers will be moved from hotels into barracks. And that will save a ton of money for the Treasury, for the public purse. Even as they continue with the Gordian knot of trying to stop these crossings, which of course became, and indeed remain, a consequence of policies brought in by the previous government and partly a consequence of Brexit-related changes to our immigration system, but mostly a consequence of policies brought in by the last government. The calculation in Downing Street is that this will matter. That the people sort of sticking flags up on your lamppost and shouting stop the boats at the television are a proportion of the potential vote. The people who are currently entranced by Nigel Farage's rancid rhetoric are not part of that group of people. They are people who genuinely feel, whether they should or not is moot, because they genuinely feel that their own life is being negatively affected by people crossing the English Channel in small boats. And that feeling is exacerbated by two things. The figures, the costs, the numbers that are published routinely, and the occasional hideous crime committed by somebody accommodated in one of these facilities. Those two things create a personal reaction to the reality. They create a personal reaction to the facts. Whether they should or not, again, is moot. It doesn't matter because people feel things and politicians have to reflect or embrace those feelings. It seems to me that the government is currently betting the house on people having a rational approach to asylum seeking. So Keir Starmer and his closest advisers today are arguing that if we save a ton of money on accommodating asylum seekers, that will be good politics. That will be good for the economy, it will be good for the country, and it will be good, crucially, for our political fortunes. Now, if you spend time on Twitter, you would conclude, I suppose and suspect, because happily I don't anymore, that they are completely wasting their time because we don't want any of them here and we'd rather they were drowned in the middle of the English Channel and we should be shooting them out of cannons and taking them back to as yet unspecified and quite possibly non-existent countries where we could just drop them off and wash our hands and leave. But Twitter, despite what political parties seem to think, is not real life. Okay. I don't know. I actually don't know whether this is good politics or not. I don't know whether you, as someone who has, for example, a problem with me, perhaps, politically sometimes, or somebody who has, I'm going to say fallen for, but I accept that that might be an unfair... let's say you live in an area where there is little or no immigration at all. There's a piece on the BBC today about Buxton, a town I know quite well and I've always had a particular soft spot for, but which has fallen under the Farageist spell, despite having, I think, a 97 or 98% white population. Probably still not high enough for Sarah Pochin or Robert Jenrick, but, you know, statistically incredibly high. And they've fallen under the spell. So the message being sent to them is, well, they were never staying in four-star hotels, these people, but the perception that they were being too generously accommodated has taken such a hold upon parts of the population that Keir Starmer is trying to remove its grip. Let's get those words exactly right. The perception that asylum seekers are being too lavishly and generously accommodated has reached a point where it doesn't matter whether it's true or not, we as a government have to act as if it is. Therefore, we have to make the accommodation that asylum seekers are accessing measurably and observably less salubrious. And it doesn't matter that it's not very nice at the moment. The presence of the word hotel in the conversation has got halfway around the world before the truth has got its trousers on. Okay? Keir Starmer's calculation is that there are lots and lots and lots of people who actually will be much more comfortable with this phenomenon if these people were housed in much more primitive accommodation. If these people were housed in much more, in much less salubrious accommodation. That is the calculation. Very simply, Keir Starmer thinks that there are millions of people in this country who will be less exercised by the nativist bile and the racism of Nigel Farage and his colleagues if asylum seekers were staying in less luxurious... Well, they're not luxurious. You see the problem with words. If asylum seekers were housed in army camps instead of repurposed hotels. And I think it is an absolutely huge miscalculation. Because, and I want you to tell me that I'm wrong, but I don't know that anyone will. So you just have to queue up to tell me that I'm right. Because the kind of people who are most exercised by Stop the Boats not only live in areas that are entirely, are largely unaffected by immigration in general, never mind asylum seekers in particular, but they don't care. It's a lie to say, I don't mind. I think they've been lying all along about what we just care about how much it costs, or we care about the fact that it's a three-star hotel and I can't be bothered to do my research to establish that it's nothing of the sort, or a four-star hotel, or whatever it is. Keir Starmer thinks it's good politics to put these people in army camps. Do you? 0345-6060973 is the number that you need. And I don't know if you're going to like me for saying this, but I do believe that there are an awful lot of people currently not goose-stepping behind Nigel Farage's nativist bile, who have just been persuaded by the constant cavalcade of coverage that this is a major and personal problem. And yet I don't actually think they're all racist. I've never met a racist who doesn't like reform, but I've met lots of people who I don't think are racists who also currently feel it's like the don't give an F button. It's like Brexit 2.0. I'm going to vote for this because everything's a mess, and why not just throw a firework into the middle of the party, which is never a very nice or clever thing to do, but I can understand the levels of frustration that might prompt people to do it. But I just don't know how many of them there are. I don't know how many of you there are. I don't have a problem with asylum seekers, James. I don't have a problem with asylum applications. I understand that they need to be processed, but I just think they should be staying in hostels rather than so-called hotels or whatever it is. I just don't think they've got it. It seems to me the next election hinges upon how many people seduced by Nigel Farage's nativist rhetoric are actually nativists and racists. And I don't think that a lot of them are. I think a lot of them aren't. But I don't think Keir Starmer's I could tell you now, certain type of radio phoning, there'll be people ringing up to complain about them being put up in army camps. And you find yourself thinking, well, what do you actually want? And you know what they want. They're just not ready to say it quite yet. We want them to be lined up against a wall and shot, or we want them to be blown out of the English Channel. And of course, if someone does say that, the party leader would come along and say, well, I don't think that's racist at all. It might be a bit ugly, but I don't think it's racist at all. So, listen, it's an unnecessarily long introduction, this, because I find it such sticky and tricky territory. But the question's pretty straightforward. Keir Starmer is going to move a whole bunch of asylum seekers from repurposed and usually quite unpleasant hotels into accommodation that he can tell the British public is even more primitive. Is that good politics? Will it work? And is it you? Is it you he's trying to appeal to? And are you actually a nice person who has a reasonable and legitimate problem with a misrepresented depiction of asylum seeker accommodation? But if you know that they're staying in hostels, army camps, bunk beds, 50 to a room, you'll somehow be a lot more comfortable about it. You see what I mean? Who is... Anyway, let's take some calls. It's 11:22.
This is LBC. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m.
I have found completely shocking the extent of the anti-Semitism that people have felt because of what's been going on in the Middle East, emboldened not just to criticise the Israeli government, but to use what is happening in the Middle East as a way of allowing you to expose what you really believe. And I think a lot of people have shown themselves for what they really are.
Tom Swarbrick, with cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses. LBC.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally, and be there for us when we need them most, without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs.
Breakfast is the most important meal of the day, followed by elevenses, brunch, lunch or dinner, then tea or dinner.
Or supper, depending where you're from.
Look, can we at least agree that breakfast is the most important meal of the day? That's why Warburton's, the family bakers, teamed up with organisations like Magic Breakfast to donate millions of breakfasts this year to schools in the UK. Good stuff. It's baked in at Warburton's. To find out more, search Warburton's Good Stuff.
Taking antibiotics when you don't need them puts you and your family at risk of a longer and more severe illness. Always take your doctor's advice. Search NHS Antibiotics.
You saw me walking along the beach. You watched me turn round the headland and the tide. It cut me off. The rocks were wet, too wet to climb, so I panicked. But you didn't. You dialed 999 and asked for the Coast Guard.
Coast Guard.
And I just want to say, whoever you are, thank you.
In an emergency at the coast, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
I'm a real snack monster. But Mum and Dad says all that munching isn't good for me. Around half the sugar we eat comes from unhealthy snacks and sugary drinks. If you want to change from a snack monster to a snack star, search Change for Life. For loads of healthy snacking ideas.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 25 minutes after 11, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where it's perhaps a slightly more complicated question than some of the coverage would allow. But the government has calculated, or is calculating, that moving asylum seekers to army camps will please some of the people currently falling for or tempted to fall for Nigel Farage's nativist and increasingly racist political party. And I just want to know whether you think that that is true, whether you think that calculation is correct, whether or not a significant swathe of these people are actually reachable in a rational way with policies designed to address what may be a myth, i.e. the supposed luxury of these accommodations. But nonetheless, their needle is movable. Will the needle nudge? Rob's in Penrith. Rob, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. I'm pleased you've taken this topic up this morning. I've had a conversation...
That's the main thing. That's the main thing, Rob.
Yes. I mean, I've had a conversation with my brother a few days ago, and we ended up in a blazing row. When we discuss anything of this sort, he just gets very angry with me, and I can't discuss anything rationally with him. Mm. And the basis of his argument is that we've got to get rid of these Muslims
right.
because they're going to impose Sharia law on us.
Right.
And he's moved from the Tories, the Daily Mail reader, Tory,
yeah.
he's moved from that to Reform GB News, and he believes all this bile that's coming out about that they're going to get rid of people of colour.
And he's in favour of that, is he?
And he's absolutely in favour of it.
Deporting people with a legal right to be here.
Yes, and the two things about this. One is, there's nothing rational about this. It's completely emotional and...
And delusional.
And delusional, yes. Well, he believes all this rhetoric that's coming out of the right wing.
Do you know if the sight of black people in adverts drives him mad, Rob, or have you not had that conversation yet?
I didn't get as far as that conversation. But his wife is, posting on these things where saying, David Lammy needs to be got rid of. Put your hands if you agree, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it's obviously politicians of colour that they want to. And there's an entirely irrational fear of people of colour.
They've been radicalised.
Yes.
Who by?
They voted for Brexit.
Yeah.
They've got rid of all the rational controls on immigration in doing that. And I can only put it down to one person, mainly, aided and abetted by Boris Johnson.
Yes.
But it's Farage, and it's everything that has been to do with Farage, unfortunately. And I despair at the moment, James.
I'm sure you do.
Because it's as you say, the Overton window has shifted. I watched the BBC lunchtime political programme yesterday.
Oh, yes.
There was somebody from Spiked on, a Tory, and one representative of the Labour Party. And the Labour Party representative was an apologist for what the other two were saying, really. And there was no fight back against the sort of racist direction of the discussion. And this is the way it's going. We're not getting a balanced argument anywhere in the media.
Well, present company accepted.
And
there'll be plenty of people who think that I'm hideously unbalanced, because that's the problem with facts, is that they have a bias. What intrigues me, because let's say that you and your brother are two poles here, not in the sense that you're... sister-in-law and your brother would hate, but in the sense of like poles, magnetic poles. You are poles apart, as the saying goes. And the calculation Keir Starmer and his colleagues are making is that there are a lot of people between those two poles. So the notional voter here is the one who has been persuaded. In fact, let me read you a text. This is from David, and I don't think this is healthy, because it's essentially saying, all right, you've believed complete nonsense, but we're going to treat you like a rational voter. David in Thatcham has written, I agree with putting the small boat people into army camp type accommodation. Not only will this save money, but a spin-off might be that it is a deterrent. Yeah, that's right, because risking your life is nothing compared to having to sleep in a bunk bed, in that the small boat people will learn and realise they are no longer going to be put up in a nice hotel and live on a camp. I support this idea fully. So that's a variation on the voter between the two poles, who clearly believes all the nonsense about the state of these so-called hotels, but welcomes the camps because he thinks it's a step in the right direction. How many of them do we think there are? Because that's the key to Keir's calculation.
Well, they're not getting the truth again, are they?
No.
And how many, what percentage of total immigration are the small boats? I get an estimate of anything between 4% and 7%
yes,
of the total.
That's correct. That's correct. But it's about, I think it's 70 to 80% of people that have come through irregular channels, or people who are applying for asylum. So, you can do what you want with numbers, but it should be getting 4 to 7% of the coverage of immigration-related issues, technically. But, of course, we're never going to live in that world. I'm sorry about the beef between you and your brother, and I don't know that there's anything I can recommend or advise that you do, because, of course, it's a bit like being an alcoholic or being a drug addict. You have to want to get better to begin that process, and no one is going to switch off their social media or cancel their Daily Mail subscription or stop listening to Nigel Farage until they've realised how low they have been brought by their addiction, in this case to to hatred and bile, which is all some people have. I don't underestimate that. And I'm sure you've been a great brother to him, but it will be other things that have gone on in his life that have rendered him addicted to hatred and convinced that, what, deporting David Lammy will somehow improve his life? Here's Thomas Watts with your headlines.
A Royal Navy patrol vessel is in the Caribbean to support the response to Hurricane Melissa. The Category 5 storm is expected to make landfall in Jamaica and could bring catastrophic flooding and landslides. Sir Keir Starmer's reportedly set the Home Office a target of closing all migrant hotels within a year. The government's confirmed two military barracks in Inverness and East Sussex will be used to house hundreds of people. Prunella Scales, best known for her role as Sybil in Fawlty Towers, has died at the age of 93. Her sons say the actress died peacefully at her home in London yesterday. LBC weather, mostly dry with sunny spells for many, showers in Scotland, Northern Ireland and parts of Northern England. A high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
Being your own boss has plenty of benefits. Video calls from your home office and spreadsheet admin to the scent of roasting coffee in a cafe. But how secure is the connection you're using? And how can you ensure that your devices, data and digital assets are protected? Just ask BT.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah,
that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
I like my private details on a need-to-know basis. In other words, I need to know them and you don't. That's why I use Bitdefender whenever I'm connected, working tirelessly in the background to protect me across all my devices, keeping my digital identity confidential, on the down low, on the hush-hush, trusted by the experts, used by the pros.
Bitdefender, a global leader in cybersecurity. Trusted, always.
Verify now at bitdefender.com.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can wind down and catch up. A chance to let conversations flow and plans unfold. And swap doomscrolling for telling stories. Too good for the group chat. Make the journey part of the joy and save one third with off-peak group tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
You asked, BT answered.
Having a firewall is essential for any small to medium-sized company. Think of it as a digital bouncer, monitoring and controlling what enters and leaves your network. It'll block anything suspicious trying to get through.
Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Search BT Business Cybersecurity to find out more.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
11:34 is the time. I think I've worked it out. Apologies for not doing this before I come on air, but I'm never going to change. It's worked pretty well over the years, so I'm not going to interfere with a winning formula. But Keir Starmer is appealing to people who believe things that are not true, but which he thinks are just about true enough to matter. So our friend in Thatcham, who thinks that asylum seekers are being housed in the kind of hotels he goes on holiday to, you know, that building that has four stars on a sign outside still offers up the accommodation that we paid for when we went on our holidays to Devon in the 1980s. Do you see what I mean? It's absolute nonsense. These people are living in the bare minimum. But that doesn't matter. Keir Starmer has chosen not to have that fight. And I'm about to suggest that that was the right decision, because there's no point having that fight, because all that you do, if you're Rob's brother, or rather if you're feeding propaganda to Rob's brother, all that you do is focus on how much money has been made and how much money is being spent, no matter that it's going to precisely the sort of people that Michael Gove put on his VIP crony lane during the PPE crisis. You don't mention that in the original headline that just says we're spending a gazillion pounds on housing asylum seekers. There's no point pointing out that the massive majority of that money is going not to asylum seekers, but to people who owned the previously failing and run-down hotels. So you move them into army camps, because you're dealing with people who believe things that aren't true, but they're just true enough to matter. So they're not living in luxury, but it is costing a fortune. And a policy that would cost a lot less will therefore appeal to rational, non-racist people who have, quote, legitimate concerns. And I really, really, really want there to be millions of people in that category, because the alternative is that they're all racist. And I don't believe that. There's just rather more of them than perhaps any of us realised, even in the run-up to Brexit. That's a bit Freudian. Tamara is in Telford. Tamara, what would you like to say?
Yes, we're still morning. Good morning, James. First time caller.
Welcome.
Just a few things to say. People with issues on immigration are absolutely not all racist. No. I just think the racists have the loudest voices currently.
Well, also, it's the tickets for the ghost train. Isn't it? The queue's always going to be longer for the ghost. If I'm telling you that they're going to steal your jobs or molest your women, and then, you know, I find one who is a sex offender, it's proof that they all are. It just speaks to something primal and atavistic inside some people, inside all of us, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's become a very political issue, and it shouldn't be. It should be a moral issue, but it is a political issue, and regardless of, and I think yours and my politics are very different, but I think all political parties have failed in this. They've failed in the communication, they've failed in actions. And at the core to this, I think there's one issue that's not being talked about, and that issue is the failure of the Home Office and the services responsible for working through asylum status. We've always been a country, regardless of your politics as an individual, we have always been a country that has been there to help and support people less fortunate than ourselves. And I don't want to be part of a country where that becomes not the norm. But not everyone that is entering our country is a genuine asylum seeker, and the media is responsible for lumping them all into one bracket. And we do not process these things quickly enough. We have
deliberately last lot, it was deliberate. I mean, you say it's not being talked about enough. It reported literally yesterday, and I'm sure you know this, that the Home Office had squandered billions of pounds on accommodation. Billions.
Yeah, but it has been, that's been going on for 20 years. It's been going on across all governments. And
Yes and no. I mean, the very specific problem of small boats, which is the focal point of most of the rhetoric, is a direct consequence of decisions taken by the last Tory government.
Yeah, but that's that issue, but that doesn't change the issue of illegals in the country from prior to small boats. James, it was Asians working underground in Chinese and Indian takeaways. There's always been an illegal issue that has not been handled correctly.
No, that's true, but I guess...
And that's the core of it.
Well, I don't think it is the core of it. The core of it is clearly the scale and the backlog. It's not, I mean, so there are two very, I think there are two different conversations there. I agree with everything you said up until that point. But in terms of what needs to be addressed by the current government, the fact that no country can have a hermetically sealed border is not what the current rhetoric is about. It's about the asylum backlog, which is a very, very deliberate consequence of Tory party policies. You can tell, because what Cammie Badenoch said when it was pointed out that billions of pounds had been squandered by the last half a dozen Tory governments, she started wanging on about the Rwanda scheme again.
Oh, no, please, look, as an ex-conservative, please don't go there.
No, I won't, I won't. But what I will do is nudge you towards this decision by this government in the context of this crisis, this perceived crisis.
Is it politically astute of Keir Starmer?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Politically astute, because to the rhetoric out there, all in hotels and what have you, and I agree with you, they are not being run as they were as hotels, or they may be, which is why they failed.
Yeah.
But the issue is what it is costing us, and that should be addressed, and that's not so much political, that's essential of any government.
And fiscal, but how many Tamaras are there? How many Tamaras are there? That's the key question for me.
Shall I tell you, there are more of us than you think.
I hope so.
Why are we afraid to speak, James? Because the minute I were to raise immigration as an issue in any circle today, I get the finger pointed at me and I'm asked if I'm a racist because I want to discuss how we resolve it.
I'm not going to call you a liar. And I'm not, and I'm not going to call you a racist.
You do.
But because I come from a political environment,
and I'm a parish councillor.
Yeah, but you must be living in the only corner of the country. I mean, everywhere else, Tamara, racism is going unchallenged and unchecked.
Oh no, racism should be challenged, should be checked.
Well, we had epic racism at the weekend from the Reform UK MP talking about how discomforted she is, or driven mad by the sight of black and brown people in television adverts. I mean, quite where it is.
Well, the thing is, that was unintelligence on her part.
It was also racist.
Oh, it was absolutely racist, but she thought it was going to hit differently.
But you've got a Daily Mail columnist today defending it. I don't want to get distracted. If people are accusing you of racism because you want to talk about immigration, then...
I have had that. And what I do is, I like talking to you, I qualify that I might be a capitalist, but I'm a centrist, and I'm a libertarian. I have always believed the key part of this country is that we welcome all,
and the details matter.
And we look after people who are less fortunate than ourselves, but it has to be done in the right way, and I don't think it's being done in the right way.
I don't disagree with a single syllable that you said in that field. A little bit about the conflation with historic illegal immigration, but that's a conversation for another decade.
But I think it just sits inherently that the Home Office has never got it.
That's true.
Together.
That's also true. £7 billion for organisations that provide accommodation, tens, hundreds of millions, and I bet they're not ex-Tories. All these people that trousered these contracts during the last few Tory administrations. Hang on, I want to pin you down on something.
I
hope that you're right, and there are lots of Tamaras out there, but. And if there are, then Starmer's got it right, because people are going to respond by saying we need to process these applications more quickly.
Yes.
And we need to be, well, this is less generous while we're processing them. And if they get that...
Is it less generous?
Well, that's the word I'm struggling with.
No, have you been to... Right, in my hometown, this is also the other thing that these very vocal people about, we're putting people in hotels.
Yes.
Local council area, and because I've been involved in politics, this is true.
Yes.
We have put emergency homeless people in hotels for years.
I know.
And they are not luxury.
No, I know. And they're actual hotels. They are still hotels. Most of the asylum processing centres, most of the asylum accommodations are no longer taking normal paying guests.
No, they're not. They're not. And, but also, local authorities now are losing their spaces for where they used to deal with our homeless.
All right, not generous then. And you could tell from my voice I thought it was the wrong word. I'm trying to think of a better word to describe, because, you know, it's...
Most of these were failing hotels. No,
I know that. No, you're absolutely... And you and me agreeing on almost everything.
I can't believe this, James.
I don't know why, because you haven't said anything. I'm sorry that you deal with people who think anything that you've said is controversial, because it hasn't been. And you are... we've had Mondeo Man, we've had Worcester Woman. I'm going to have Telford Tamara moving forward. It's all about Telford tomorrow. The people who maybe, I've got a diversity of political opinions, but you like this policy because it seems to address a very real problem. And the very real problem is, if we boil it right down to brass tacks, we're spending too much money on this issue.
Yeah, I like it if it's being done for the right reason.
Yeah, okay.
I like it if it is being done to reduce costs, to speed up
processes,
and it is not just shifting an issue to make the media and the people who are screaming the loudest happy, and nothing underneath changes. If underneath doesn't change and we don't improve the process and get genuine asylum seekers safe, then it's not being done for the right reasons.
I am so glad you called in today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to me.
Well, thank you for giving me so much to listen to. Go on.
And just to let you know, people like me, how do I describe myself currently? I am totally and utterly politically homeless, James.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. I know roughly on the spectrum of political parties you would once have sat where you still might expect to sit, but that is a big gap. How many Telford Tamaras are there? That's the key question. Keir Starmer is calculating that there are a lot. Having listened to the position so perfectly explained, I'm inclined to join him at least in hoping that there are, but... how many times have we sat here listening to people put forward incredibly well thought through, rational and well evidenced opinions, positions, explanations, only to hear somebody else come at the same issue with a hat full of ignorance and bile? And because their voice is louder, or because they sell more papers, or because they get more clicks, they drown out Tamara Telford, or Telford Tamara. It's 11:47.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Right, royal scandal took another twist yesterday when the King visited Lichfield Cathedral in Staffordshire.
How long have you known about Andrew and Epstein?
Well, let's bring the heckler, who wants to be known as L, into the conversation. What did you achieve, apart from shouting at an elderly man who has cancer?
What it has done is brought it back into the public eye.
What do you want to happen now as regards Prince Andrew?
I think what is needed is a full-scale royal inquiry. I have seen many comments phrase it as disrespectful, but my reply to that is, what about the lack of respect being shown to the victims?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
With cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses.
Back tomorrow morning from 7, LBC.
Trains are three bridges for two adults, one skeleton and one fairy werewolf, as you do.
Just one pumpkin, kids! Charlie, not that one, mate. It's nearly as big as you.
Back on the train with two little monsters and a couple of pumpkins. Now off home to spend a good 3 hours carving. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
You plan a holiday, you plan a commute, meal plans, career plans, even workouts need a plan. So doesn't it stand to reason that your money has one too? Because the sad truth is, if it doesn't, it's just sitting there, barely growing, if at all. That's why you need a money plan. And Quilter can help. It's a lot easier to stick to than a workout plan. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Big, big, big motoring world. Wow Motoring World.
Yes, that's right. Big Motoring World is also Wow Motoring World because we price check our cars every day to guarantee you our best price, with up to 95% of them below market value. Big Motoring World. We're big on what matters to you. See website for nearest store. Visit bigmotoringworld.co.uk or one of our stores for our price promise and terms and conditions.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
11:50 is the time. Robin Penrith touched quite a few of you, the tale of his estranged and radicalised brother. This begins with a capital lettered request not to read out the texter's name, but you'll soon see why. My partner is constantly bombarded with far-right Islamophobic posts on Instagram. Tommy Robinson, anti-Sadiq Khan. She believes Sharia law is inevitable. Radicalised is the only word I can use. It's driven a wedge between us. I love her, and this is the greatest sadness I feel. I'm going to just remove that from my screen so that I don't accidentally say your name. I'm so sorry to read that, mate. We got a lot of this after Brexit. We got a lot of it during the anti-vax conspiracies. And, of course, there's an enormous cross-section there between the Farageist bile that is currently engulfing the country, the anti-vax conspiracists, who, of course, were invited onto stage at Reform UK, alongside the woman who incited racial hatred against hotels full of asylum seekers, and Mr. Brexit himself, although he doesn't like to talk about that anymore. Doesn't like to talk about Russia either, but I think it's probably time that he did. And we may look a little more closely at why in the next hour of the programme. But for now, a little bit of gratification there from Telford Tamara, many of whom are joining her. Hashtag I stand with Tamara seems to be the fashion of the moment. Michelle says, I am a Telford Tamara, and so are most of the people I know. Keith up in Glasgow says, I'm a Telford Tamara, James. Lots of people are, and that's the calculation. Because you know what? That's one of those calls that's going to stay with me. Because the mess that the Home Office made, if this report had actually covered a period of Labour government, all of the front pages yesterday would have been Labour's Home Office squandered billions. But they can't do that, because it wasn't. So it is Home Office squandered billions. Kemi Badenoch conceded last night that the previous governments had made mistakes, but insisted that the Rwanda plan would have somehow fixed everything like a giant magic wand. That's the point. Again, back to the media. Labour's Home Office. It wasn't. It was Tory policies. Listen, it was a mess under Labour. I think John Reid or David Plunkett? One of them said so. Home Office, absolute mess. Siphoning money, channeling money, throwing money at people running substandard accommodation for asylum seekers. So if you're Keir Starmer, right, and you're Mr. Process, it doesn't matter that they're not four-star hotels, even if Farage keeps telling people that they are. It doesn't matter that they're not very nice places to live in and that you've got very little money to live on when you're there. What matters is the amount of money the Home Office is spending on them. So the priority around this table in Downing Street is to reduce that amount of money, which is what they do by moving asylum seekers to repurposed army transit camps. What's not to like? As long as they are clean and safe. And it saves a ton of money, most of which was making its way into precisely the sort of pockets that Michael Gove put on the VIP lane, but didn't stop him getting a peerage. Rosa's in Camberley. Rosa, what would you like to say?
Hey, I think I might unfortunately be...
Undo the Tamara Telford effect. Like. Yes, go on.
I know hope is scarce and nice to hold on to, but first I'll say the really important thing. The asylum seekers were actually housed in army barracks for a period of time before they were put in hotels. Do you remember in like Folkestone and Napier barracks?
Yes, vaguely.
Yes. So this went on for some time. And even back then, see, I remember because this was like my hyper-focus. I got really exercised by it because they were out in the sticks in these awful conditions that they didn't like to be in. I mean, there were interviews from men like showing bullet wounds in their hips saying, I came from war and they put me in an army camp. Like, what is this? But I'll say when I actually went to Navy Barracks to interview men, the first thing they said, despite all of that, was I would just like to work. Right. Mm. They do just genuinely want to get on
I think they're still there. This is, I mean, it may be reported in a way that makes it look like something new, but think of it more of an expansion of something that is already being done. I think Wethersfield in Essex has a similar thing in place as well.
What I'm saying is that didn't work. There were still far right agitators gathering outside of the barracks.
But that doesn't mean it's not working. What it's designed to do is massively reduce the expenditure on accommodation for asylum seekers. Mm. If you focus exclusively on that, then the more of it there is, the more successful the policy becomes.
I can see that, but also I don't think you're giving like yourself enough credit for a minute.
That's very unlikely. That's highly unlikely, Rosa, and also impossible.
Well, what I'm just saying is you say, well, Keir Starmer can't explain that, you know, this is the result of privatization and stuff like this, but you're doing it. You are explaining it. It can be done.
Yeah, but I don't reach the point.
The government that oversaw it for the last 14 years, they can quite feasibly, if that is, they follow through on these things. say we're not going to have these companies siphoning off loads
but
for
profit. He's doing that. And also, I mean, listen, you're kind, and I'm good, but I'm not that good. I can't compete against the Daily Mail, the Daily Express, the Daily Telegraph, the Times, the Sun, GBBs, whatever the other one is, that talk something. I can't. I can do my bit, and I can have a more popular show than any of them have got, but I can't win, ever.
Not alone, and Keir Starmer's leaving you alone, well, right?
It's not really. Because Keir Starmer would be up against all of them as well. And you might call it cowardly, but it's also probably rational. To that's what I mean by saying people believe things that aren't true, but they're just true enough to matter. So they believe things that aren't true about the hotels, and they should be focused upon who's making all the money, but it is true that we're spending too much money on them. So he can fix one of those three things, he would argue. And you might find that a bit craven, but politics is the art of compromise.
I also, you know, I do just find it hard to stomach because from my knowledge that was a bad place to be. There's at least two news articles about people being taken away from the barracks in ambulances because they made attempts on their lives.
And I'm not going to come back at that with anything other than that could have happened anywhere.
I mean, yes, but also it's pretty immiserating conditions. You don't wash in privacy. You are in a long room with loads of people. You don't know. I think miserable conditions is going to make desperation and that kind of thing more likely. I mean, it would for anyone, right?
Yeah, I mean, not to be light. To make light of what you're describing, but that, you know, that sounds like a 1980s public school.
Yeah.
And that messed us all up. It's coming up. Thank you. And I wasn't making light of it. It is literally what popped into my mind when you described communal washing and dormitories with 30 beds in them. And that is part of the problem. It all goes a bit honest Bob Jenrick at the end there, where you think, how can we make life even worse for these people? So Jenrick is appealing to that category, Rob's brother. How can we make life even worse for these people who are largely desperate and vulnerable? Largely. Not exclusively, but show me a population, show me a cohort, a demographic of people who are all anything. And I'll call you a liar. So Jenrick says, how can we make life worse for them? Starmer's policy looks a bit like that. It's not going to satisfy the people who want life to be made worse for asylum seekers. But it is perhaps going to reach some people who simply want to be seeing less of their tax money go into this accommodation because it looks too expensive. It looks horribly inflated. It looks excessive. And spoiler alert, it is. The Home Office squandered billions. Found a committee of MPs, an investigation by a select committee. And we've also seen stories about where the money is going, although not that many, because of course it's going into precisely the same pockets that end up buying newspapers if they make enough cash. So you're not going to be reading it in many of the newspapers or hearing it on many of the programmes that are also in the service of Epic Wealth. But that's nice. I'm more optimistic than I was an hour ago.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, a Royal Navy ship has been placed on standby as Jamaica braces for the island's strongest storm on record. The Category 5 storm, Hurricane Melissa, is expected to bring 4-metre waves and winds of up to 175 miles per hour when it makes landfall. It's understood there are about 8,000 British nationals in the country. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, says it's a very serious storm.
We've set up the crisis centre here in the Foreign Office to provide 24-hour consular assistance to British nationals, but also to monitor Hurricane Melissa and to make sure we are ready and stand ready to provide UK support to Jamaica. I've spoken to the Jamaican Foreign Minister to offer our support and solidarity.
A defence minister has told LBC that further MOD sites are being identified to replace asylum hotels. The Home Office has confirmed two barracks in Inverness and East Sussex will be used to house about 900 men. Rachel Reeves is reportedly facing a larger-than-expected gap in the public finances ahead of next month's budget. The additional shortfall of £20 billion is understood to be the result of a downgrade to productivity levels in official forecasts. The Treasury has declined to comment on the reports. Conservative frontbencher Alex Burghardt says it's enormously concerning.
It's not really any surprise in that at the last budget, the Chancellor put the worst business taxes on our economy that we've seen in about 50 years. And the end result is that that people aren't hiring, the economy's not growing.
Three more Reform UK county councillors in Kent have been expelled. The party says they've been thrown out for dishonest and deceptive behaviour in a leaked video meeting. Reform took control of the authority at the local elections in May. Amazon has announced it's cutting 14,000 jobs worldwide. It's unclear what the impact will be in Britain, where the company employs 75,000 people. The firm wants to step up its use of artificial intelligence. Prunella Scales has died at the age of 93. A statement from her son says the actress, who had vascular dementia, died peacefully at home in London yesterday. She was best known for her role as Sybil in Fawlty Towers, starring alongside John Cleese.
Shall I deal with this, Basil?
I'm dealing with it, dear.
No, dear, that's all right. Now you wanted two singles.
I said I'd deal with it.
Do you mind sharing your bathroom?
Look, I was here first.
Well, it's my turn now, then.
I fought the Korean War, you know. I killed four men.
In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 96.58. That's up 4 points. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 14. LBC weather this afternoon, mostly dry with sunny spells, but some showers developing in Scotland, Northern Ireland and parts of Northern England. A high of 14 Celsius. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer. We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 12 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Here's a test of how closely you listen to the programme. There is one topic that I would be keen to do more of, even though I'm not going to give you any clues, but the producer won't let me. Do you know what it is? There's one topic historically, which Eleanor has, we did it once, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I thought it was absolutely sparkling radio. If we ever got nominated for any awards, we'd have won them all with that one. But she thought it was rubbish. Absolute pants. And she's not let me go near it any time since. Big news in that world today. Big news in the world that I'm not allowed to acknowledge the existence of. Why does everyone keep sending me messages asking me if I'm going to be talking about headlights today? No, I'm not going to be talking about headlights. Why would I talk about headlights? But it is, to give you a clue, it is a vaguely motoring related... Well, not even vaguely. Yes, it is. Buses. Huge news in bus land today, did you know? A new era of better buses is dawning in the United Kingdom as the landmark bus bill becomes law. The Bus Services Act, it's called. And it will make it easier for local leaders to take control of their buses and put passengers first. I'm not in the right mood to defy the producer today. By the end of the week, I might be. But that is your two-minute warning on... or your two-day warning. You need... Because I need to wear her down a bit. So, you know, I'll come in with some really rubbish ideas tomorrow. And she'll go, oh, my God, that's rubbish. And I say, what about buses? And she'll go, no, not buses. And then on Thursday, I'll come in with some even more rubbish ideas. And she'll go, oh, don't worry, we've got mystery hour. We only need two. I'll go, oh, rats, foiled again. And then on Friday, I'll come in. I'll say, let's talk about headlights for an hour. And she'll go, oh, all right, let's do buses. So tune in on Friday for the landmark bus bill that has become law today, the Bus Services Act. I mentioned the producer because I was thinking of using her as a case study for the next conversation. The headline says, Rise of Depressing Jobs to Cost Britain £1 billion. And I thought we could invite the producer on to tell us what it's like to have a really depressing job. What do you have to do? I have to deal with James O'Brien every day, all day. Well, not all day. He goes home happily at 1:30, unless he's got a podcast, in which case he hangs around getting on everyone's nerves in the office. But it's not really a depressing job. £1 billion. I'm never quite sure how they calculate these things, but you're looking at high rates of depression, anxiety and stress, all of which are surging. The Health Foundation, which is a think tank, a good one, not one that refuses to tell us who funds it or indeed sponsors its ludicrous output, like most of the ones surrounding Tufton Street, has said that recruitment was growing in industries including health and care, where workers are particularly likely to suffer from depression, stress and anxiety. Now, I don't want to do this in a flippant way, but neither do I want it to rob us entirely of the optimism that Telford Tamara managed to inject into the national pageant half an hour or so ago. I just want to know, and only you know this, what it's like to be sure that your job is making you ill. During some of the recent developments in this country, people have presumed that I find it hard to do this job. And the opposite is true. I get just as depressed as you do by the rise of racism in our shores. Well, not quite as... Well, obviously I'm white, so it's going to be a lot more traumatising and a lot more upsetting if you're not. But the normalisation of racism, the way in which people are now just treating racism like another both sides argument. Is it actually racist to say that you don't like seeing black faces on the television? Oh, I don't think so. Is it actually racist to say that you don't like seeing black faces in Handsworth or brown faces in Birmingham? Oh, I don't know. It's just ugly. It's everywhere. So I told you this was going to happen. I told you 10 years ago, give or take, about being called into the BBC, less than 10 years, just after I left Newsnight, called into the BBC to speak to all of their journalists, or actually to have a debate with one of their biggest names about how they should be covering these issues. And I said, you've got to stop having debates about whether racism is racism, and you've got to start describing racism as racism. You don't necessarily have to call people racist, although you should certainly think about it, but you need to call racism racism. You need to have a company policy on what constitutes racism. And you could throw in some case studies, like not wanting to live next door to people according to their country of origin as opposed to their conduct in this country. Or you could call it racist when people lie about children not having English as their first. Just, you've got to start calling racism racism. And one of the biggest names, I'm not allowed to tell you who because it was Chatham House rules, but one of the biggest names at the BBC, I always remember it, said to me, I will never call Nigel Farage a racist. And I thought, well, in that case, we're probably going to be living in a country in a few years' time where his opinions are mainstream, and you'll still be sitting here having debates and conversations about whether racism is racism. So I get depressed by the direction of traffic in this country. I get depressed by the abandonment of truth. I look at people. David Aranovich has written a brilliant blog on his Substack. He's one of my favourite journalists, David Aranovich. He's absolutely brilliant. If you look at some of the people who populate the comment pages of the Times today and then reflect upon who they got rid of in the guises chiefly of Philip Collins and David Aranovich, then you'll see that the Murdochification of the Times is underway at a rate of knots at the moment as well. But he's on Substack, and he wrote about bumping into an old colleague, presumably from the Times, who used the phrase Trump derangement syndrome with a straight face. And David has done what I keep meaning to do, which is to make a list of all the reasons why, if you are not utterly disgusted by Donald Trump, then you're the one who is deranged. It's a classic example of projection. Accuse them of the thing that you are guilty of. I'm so deranged I'm making excuses for a self-confessed sex offender. But you're the one with Trump derangement syndrome. I'm so deranged that I am comfortable with the idea of someone knocking down half the White House without any permission or telling us who's paying for it. But you're the one with Trump derangement syndrome. I'm so deranged that I'm defending somebody conducting extrajudiciary killings in the middle of the ocean without any evidence or rationale for yes, but you're the one who's got Trump derangement. Anybody using that phrase is a poster boy or a poster girl for the decline of the West, which is another thing they accuse everybody else of being responsible for. But I love my job because I get to vent. You're my therapist. I come to work even during the maddest periods of Brexit. We had fun together. It's getting a little harder now to have fun because the racism is moving up almost on a daily basis. But at least we got each other. It's like that old advert. Do you remember that advert? It was for a bank, I think. They're sitting on a sofa going, just want to be together. We just want to be together. I loved that. So I've got the best job in the world. Even, if not especially, during the difficult times. Because who else gets to do this? And people say to me, thank you for keeping me sane. I say, listen, well, two things. Number one, how do I know you are sane? And number two, it's two-way traffic. You keep me sane as well. So I don't actually have a job that would be depressing. I'm also obviously well rewarded for doing it. But some people do. And some people will hate the job that they're doing, even as it makes them depressed. Whereas some people will be working from a sense of duty. And they can derive some pride from the duty, but not enough to overcome the depression. And this isn't a question I've ever asked you before. What is it like to have a job? Is it enough to say that you hate? I mean, or do we need to say a job that's making you depressed? How much do you have to hate your job before it actually makes you depressed? Is that the question? Help me out here. 0345 60 60 973 is the number that you need. Of all the things that map the gulf between people in privileged positions and people not in privileged positions, this, well, is that even true as well? Because I know a bloke who had a full-on breakdown working for £1.5 million a year for a hedge fund, and the stress just broke him. The stress broke him. What makes a job depressing? I've got a feeling, and you can shoot me down in flames on this one, I've got a feeling that this is a little bit more of a cocktail than we might realise. The most depressed I've been in my job had more to do with the people I was working with than the job I was doing. No offence, Keith. The most depressed I've been at work, and I don't use the term clinically, the toughest time, I always think of the shower as being a fairly good place to work out how you feel about work. Because it's in the shower in the morning that you find yourself contemplating the day ahead. And if your heart sinks at the very prospect, is it the job or is it the context? Is it the colleagues? So twice in my life, I have really not wanted to go to work. Once here and once when I was working in retail. And I had one of those managers who was professionally awful. Absolutely awful. If you had nothing to do, he'd unfold jumpers and make you fold them up again, even if they were folded perfectly the first time. One time he accused me of stealing because I went up a ladder, which I shouldn't have had to do, health and safety. I went up a ladder and he saw the label poking out the back of my pants that my mum had bought me for Christmas and accused me in front, called me into the office in front of a witness and accused me of stealing my pants because he'd seen the label poking out the back of the boxer shorts that my mum had bought for me the previous Christmas. And he even went back through the product record to establish that they had been on sale that December when I didn't work in the shop, so that he couldn't prove that I was lying by revealing, oh, we only started selling them in March, so you must have stolen those pants. That was all. Didn't last for long, because he didn't last for long. And the other lads I was working with in that particular shop, which close listeners to the programme will probably have already identified, it wasn't in London, we had a great old time. We had a grand old time. Colleagues make a job. In fact, all the best times you've had at work, unless you do something weird like this, if you actually talk to colleagues, whether you're working on a shop floor, in a factory or in an office, the quality of colleague that you have is such a key definer of the quality of work, isn't it? I think it is. So what is it that made that job you did so depressing? And what's the difference between a really depressing job and just being unlucky with who you're with or who your boss is? A job that is in and of itself depressing. And because I don't want it to be too dark, use the word as also in a non-clinical sense, as I have done. And if it's something that you can smile about now, then you'll be particularly welcome during this hour. Because the question is, obviously, what's the most depressing job you've ever done? And what's the difference between... Oh, I hate it when this happens. I start talking about something. I've got a million questions popping out of my head. What's the difference, I'm now thinking, between boring and depressing? Because for some of us, boring is depressing. But for others, boring is quite soothing. You know, there are days when you might think, oh, I wish I had a boring job. I wish I could just sit there. I don't know. Taking all the misshapen Mars bars off the production line. What's the most depressing job you've ever had? This is nice. Try working in a call centre. It's like being an idiot's corner for 7 hours a day. But I'm there as well, isn't it? I don't, so, you know. What is the most depressing job you've ever had? Whether you're using the word colloquially, as we mostly do, or more seriously, as this story does. There's quite a lot there, isn't there? And yeah, it was River Island. You're right. It's terrible how much I've shared with you over the years. I'm not even going to need to write an autobiography at this rate, because I've put it all out there on the radio. 12:16 is the time. What is the most depressing job you've ever done? And on a less light-hearted note, what does it do? What does a depressing job actually do to you? For someone who's never actually had one, but possibly even thinks that they have. Do you see what I mean? How do you define it? A job that actually, not to make light of anything, but sapped your will to live, not just your will to turn up for work every day. 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
Hey, it's me, your dishwasher. I'm sorry about the chaos last night. I think a fork got jammed in my racks. Whoops. Don't even check the bills. I've overdone it. Don't get mad, okay? But I used up lots of power yesterday. Sometimes you just have to blow off some steam.
It can feel like all your energy does is take, take, take. But the longer you're with OVO, the more rewards you get. OVO, do energy differently. Beyond customers only, eligibility required, redemption limits apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink, auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com, that's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
A Southern train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to skip traffic and glide to wherever you need to be. With headspace to focus on more important matters. Like if that cloud is a starfish or sunflower. Fast journeys without the rush with great deals at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
12:19 is the time. Mark's in Brighton on depressing jobs. What made you pick up the phone, Mark?
Hello, James. Hello. I'll try and summarise it. I had a corporate job about 10 years ago. It was a beautiful sunny day, sort of springtime. I knew what I was doing, so the job was quite comfortable. You know, yeah. I wasn't worried about the job as such because I knew what I was doing. I was walking through, I won't say where I was walking because it would give away the company, but I was having a little 10-minute walk to the next office. I was quite looking forward to the meeting because, again, I knew what I was doing. And yeah. I just suddenly sank to my knees, sobbing, and dropped my laptop out of the middle of nowhere.
Oh, mate.
It shocked me to the core. I'm 60 now, so, and I was raised by my grandparents, so it's kind of, you know, shocked me to the core.
Yeah.
After months, I decided to go to the doctor because I was getting a shortness of breath and anxiety in these meetings that I usually enjoyed, and he diagnosed I was having a breakdown. So that's what so that's the second point. I think you touched on it. I thought I'll ring up and I'll tell him something he doesn't know, and then you went and said it. And,
God, that's annoying.
Yeah, indeed you are. It's not the job, it's the people.
Right.
So it's not the task. I was very good at my job, I believe, and it's the politics of corporate life. The hey, Mark, that's a great job you're doing there, whatever. You turn the corner by the water cooler, to yeah. use a ridiculous term, and you can hear the same person say, I want him out in 3 months. And so sometimes I was contracting in my work, and on one particular job for a very happy fronted company, British company,
yeah.
Really happy, big corporate in London, and on the first day I saw a laptop thrown at someone's head.
Really?
That was the over aggression, but there was loads of just politics.
So what do you think, I mean, you didn't realise that you hated it until you felt the beginnings of a breakdown? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, in hindsight, no. I mean, no.
Okay, that's really interesting, because that's what we thought was normal.
Yeah, and I'd felt the shortness of breath of going into meetings, which I used to love. You know, when you know what you're talking about and you're called into a meeting to...
I'll have to take your word for that, Mark.
Yeah. apparently, I've heard, when you know what you're talking about, you're called into a meeting. Now, the meeting's great, right? Because people look at you for the information, and you know what you're talking about. And you might have someone who's trying to counter it with, well, no, that doesn't work like that. And you're like, well, actually, I've got the facts, and this will work like this. And oh, I loved the actual task.
Right.
It was the people and the politics and the... Yeah, it was hard work. And fast forward, I'd had a genuine breakdown. I still look back with some embarrassment.
I don't say the word
genuine, but okay. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I semi-retired, realised I couldn't really afford to, couldn't face going back corporate and whatever, so took a job in Brighton fixing push bikes.
Oh, lovely.
And my boss said to me, I've only been doing it for a couple of years, my boss said to me, how are you getting on? I said, it's the best job. I sat there and I thought, when did I last look forward to going into work? So I've had the weekend off work, and by Sunday I'm itching. I'm in this job to get in on Monday. I love it. I absolutely love the job. I'm dealing with the public. My colleagues are on the similar. Well, that's the point. The low wage. You know, they're not corporate striving to get one over on someone. They're just coming to work, and they're all cyclists as well. So it might be a bit stereotypical.
Stop qualifying what you're saying.
But cyclists are generally pretty chill, you know, they just want to, you know, so anyway. So
I
said to my boss that I it's the best job I've had since 1992. Unfortunately, it's the same pay, literally the same wage I was on in 1992.
Pound for pound. I love it. That's lovely. What were you doing in 1992, if you don't mind me asking?
It was one of my first jobs out of university. I was just on a help desk.
It's the people a lot of the time. Yeah. And I mean, the topic is 50-50 or possibly 52-48, goddammit. You can have the best job in the world and then a new manager arrives or even a bullying colleague and it becomes the worst job in the world. And a lot of people really suffer, in some way that you can't always pinpoint unless someone explains it as well as Mark did. From Mark to Margaret in Newry. Margaret, what made you pick up the phone?
Oh, James, thank you for taking my call. You're so, so right. It is the people. It really is the people. It isn't the job. Believe it or not, and it doesn't matter whether you're corporate or I worked in a chip shop.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I had one colleague who was an absolute bully, a real cow. She took a disliking to me and everybody else was afraid of her.
It's funny, so, isn't it? And so the job turned overnight from one that you loved to one that you hated because of her.
Because of her. And I was there for 13 years.
Oh, dear.
Uh-huh. And put up with her for about 12 of those 13 years.
Whoa! What did she do? What was so awful?
Well, I would be standing maybe making chips, right?
Yeah.
And I'd be on the way to make
You're making me hungry, Margaret. This is ridiculous. I could just go and Savaloy.
I would be humming. I'd be humming and singing to myself because I was happy and content. Yeah. She didn't like that.
She had a problem with other people being happy, do you think?
She had a problem with other people being happy. She had a problem with me being happy, in particular me. Because I'd gone through a rather messy divorce and I'd two children and I was working in the chip shop because they are suited.
Of course.
When you have children and blah, blah, blah. And she just hated the fact that I was making good with what I was doing and she just made my life a misery. So much so that I installed in my children, I hate going to this hole. I'm going to this hole tonight. Please, 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 work hard in school. Don't get yourselves in the situation I'm in.
So it was impinging on your whole family life as well?
Yeah.
You can't leave it at work, can you, sometimes? Some people can. No. I couldn't when it happened to me. What happened to her?
She's still there, right?
Oh, right. I'm not buying any chips from that shop, Margaret. You better not name it, because I'll get into trouble. But I'm glad she's still there. You're not. So that has got to be progress. Good Lord. I want you to imagine working with this guy. Eleanor wonders whether Stuart Lee wrote this message. I don't think he did. James, I really can't believe your moronic idiocy. Firstly, every second word that comes out of your idiot gob. This is what happens when you listen to the last hour of the programme and you realise that you are one of them. So you sit there thinking, I've got legitimate concerns. I read the Daily. Basically, this is Robin Penrith's brother, who's been in touch, who thinks that what he sees on Facebook and what he sees in the paper and what Nigel Farage tells him, he thinks it's all true. And he so desperately needs to think that it's all true that he doesn't know what to do when he just catches a little glimpse of himself in the mirror when he has somehow managed to accidentally tune into a radio program that he doesn't like. So do you tune in, you tune out? Well, I do anyway. Not this guy. This guy tunes in, absolutely hates what he's hearing, doesn't tune out. Gets a little glimpse of himself in the mirror and tries to break the mirror. This is what it sounds like in word form. Firstly, every second word that comes out of your idiot gob is racism. You are obsessed with it. And in your warped mind, it's always the nasty white man that is the evil racist. In your warped mind, black Asian against white racism doesn't exist. Secondly, why is it racism to point out that there are ridiculous amounts of black brown people in adverts? It's a fact. Virtually every ad, there are more black people than white, writes someone who's definitely not a racist. White couples simply don't exist in advert world anymore. They are either black or mixed race. Maybe it is Stuart Lee. It's not Stuart Lee. It's a real person. It's Rob's brother. In advert world, white people are being cancelled, which is racism. But because it's racism against whites, it doesn't matter. All you woke moronic lefties pretend it's not happening. It's not racism. When I listen to your programme, which I do only because I can't get GB News at work, if I didn't know, I would think you were a black man with a chip on his shoulder, says someone who's definitely not a racist. And I suppose, to be fair, it is not my fault that's what you see when you look in the mirror. It really isn't. But just take that anger, take that fury, wonder where it's come from, have a little think about whether or not white families are being cancelled in advert world. Whatever you do, don't do any research into, for example, the global advertising study released in 2024 that showed definitively that ad campaigns are more inclusive, have a positive impact on profits, sales and brand worth. 392 brands, my little racist friend, across 58 countries showed almost 3.5% increase in short-term sales and more than 16% increase in the long term for brands that used inclusive advertising. Or brands that cancelled advert world, cancelled white family. Oh, come on. Honestly, vote reform. Lee's in Cambridge. Lee, I'll come to you in a minute. And again, you know, if I didn't have that approach to my inbox, maybe this would be quite a depressing job. But of course, thanks to our little racist friend there, who's definitely not a racist, but hates seeing black people on adverts and thinks that white families have been cancelled in advert land. I'm going into this news bulletin feeling rather at one, feeling rather cheerful. But hey ho, remember, if you don't like what you see in the mirror, it's not the fault of the person holding up the mirror. Here's Amelia Cox with your headlines.
The Royal Navy is on standby as Jamaica prepares for the island's strongest storm on record. Hurricane Melissa is expected to bring winds of up to 175 miles per hour and 4 metre waves when it makes landfall. LBC has been told further MOD sites are being identified to replace asylum hotels. The Home Office has so far confirmed two barracks in Inverness and East Sussex will be used to house about 900 men. And it's understood the Chancellor is facing a larger than expected hole in the public finances ahead of the budget next month. The additional shortfall of £20 billion is understood to be the result of a downgrade to productivity levels in official forecasts. LBC weather, scattered showers in the north this afternoon, cloudy and wetter in northern Scotland, mostly dry with sunny spells and the odd shower elsewhere, a high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
Hey, it's me, your dishwasher. I'm sorry about the chaos last night. I think a fork got jammed in my racks. Whoops. Don't even check the bills. I've overdone it.
Don't get mad, okay, but I used up lots of power yesterday. Sometimes you just have to blow off some steam.
It can feel like all your energy does is take, take, take. But the longer you're with OVO, the more rewards you get. OVO, do energy differently. Beyond customers only, eligibility required, redemption limits apply.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer. We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year, every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £54 million.
It'll have you dancing like nobody's watching. Yeah, baby. Just make sure nobody is watching. Get in tonight's Euro Millions draw. Play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
12:32 is the time. Rise of depressing jobs to cost Britain £1 billion. What is it like to have one? And what are the... Are there any unifying factors? My pet theory is that it will have as much to do with colleagues as it will with content of the job. But, of course, some jobs must be uniquely depressing. I was looking at Jim Gamble's CV the other day after he was forced or he felt compelled to pull himself out of the grooming gang inquiry. Top job. He was the last face, the last name in the running for the top job and the work that he used to do in the world of online sex abuse. I mean, good God, how do people do that? How do they go home after a day of sifting through that filth? I don't know whether depressing would be the right word or whether it would be something else, but it wouldn't matter who your colleagues were, would it? If you were working, it would help to be working with nice, good people who looked out for you and cared for you, but their subject matter must be utterly horrific. And of course, a supremely well-qualified candidate elected to pull out because some politicians have decided to turn it into an ego trip rather than an actually constructive exercise with the interests of victims front and centre. Speaking of which, on the subject of depressing jobs, Robert writes, "Hi James, I know a guy who utterly despises all the people he works for and doesn't think the job pays enough. But his coping strategy is A, to not show up at the office, B, to take lots of little jobs for far greater pay, and C, not to care what anyone thinks of him. He is the MP for Clacton, though, so it's not a strategy that others could get away with." Thank you, Robert. Lee's in Cambridge. Lee, what would you like to say?
Hello, mate. How you doing? You all right?
Very good.
So, yeah, it seems a lifetime ago now, but I used to be a locksmith, and I got into it very, very early.
Is it hard to get into?
I don't know so much now, but oh, I see what you did there. Very good. So basically, I was very, very young. I was only... So when I started locksmithing, I'll just give you a little bit of a backstory. I was actually 11 when I first started doing it.
Well, so, hang on a minute. Are you the Artful Dodger?
No. What happened? Unfortunately, my father passed away when I was very young, when I was 11. And my brother-in-law at the time was a locksmith. So when he passed away, it was just before the school holiday. So, to get out of my mum's hair, I went to work with him for the 6 weeks holiday, and I was like his apprentice, if you like, sweeping up and things like that. Anyway, really enjoyed it. From that, went to a Saturday job. From that, when I left school, got a full-time job. But because the guy that actually owned that particular company was a master locksmith and very good at what he did, and because of how young I was, I picked it up really quickly and was taught the proper way how to do things. But when it got to the point when I was leaving school, he didn't have nothing for me. I went to another company, and it soon turned out that I was more qualified than everyone that worked there.
Because of all the on-the-job experience you'd had, even though you might have looked like you were still wet behind the ears.
exactly. I mean, because I was trained up by, like, a, you know, a real perfectionist in his craft, shall we say, not realising, but I was taught how to do things properly. So when I went to this new company, even though I was only 16, I was like the guru. You know, I remember if ever there was a problem, someone was struggling to fix something or do something, the boss would go and ask Lee, he'll sort it out. Well, obviously, when you've got, like, middle-aged men being told to go and ask a 16-year-old how to do something...
Ah, so it made your life a misery. And when, I mean, how do we qualify it as depressing? I mean, how did it get on top of you? How did it undermine you?
Well, it was like literally, you know, I was called boy, you know, everything. Oi, boy, you know, where's this boy, you know?
Well, you were 16, and they were 45.
Yeah, but it was the way it was done. You know, that it was. Yeah. They really did take a dislike to me, and the beast.
There's a bloke at Aquascooter me used to call me boy, and I really didn't like him. I've got a name. You'd think to yourself, wouldn't you, Lee? I've got a name. Why are you calling me boy?
It was just, you know, like they'd walk in. We'd walk in from a job, and they'd go, "Where's the boy? Where's my coffee?" You know. And it used to really, really get me down. And I was, you know, a very strong-minded figure. You know, I wouldn't take any nonsense from anyone, but it was. I just left school. I wasn't a hothead, but
couldn't. Yeah, you're on a hiding to nothing, aren't you? And you're getting having them turned against you.
If you stuck up for yourself, it would be a case of, oh, you know, we've got a cocky kid here, and I didn't want to lose my job.
What are you doing now?
Literally. I'm actually a tour guide now.
Are you?
I still do a little bit of locksmithing for friends, but I'm a tour guide in Cambridge,
You weren't anywhere near the Louvre last week, were you? In Paris?
I wasn't, no. I known it had been that easy, I might have been.
And when you say locksmithing for friends, you mean they've locked themselves out or they need a new... I mean, how much locksmithing is needed among your friendship circle?
Any family or friends, if they're ever locked out or need a lock done or anything, they still call me and I'll still do it for them. You know, I still have a dabble. But,
and where do you do the tour guiding? In Cambridge?
So I've got my own company now, in Cambridge, and multi-award winning, very good.
What's it called?
Cambridge Vintage Tours.
I like it.
Yeah.
And you're in an old charabanc, are you? In an old bus or...?
So I had a vehicle custom built. It's a replica of a 1910 Model T Ford, but it's fully electric.
How fantastic! And you you do the universities and the colleges
we go around the colleges and that. Like, check us on TripAdvisor. Don't take my word for it. Multi award winning. Everyone loves it. Come and have a tour, James.
Fantastic! And if you ever get locked out of the car, you're laughing.
But there you go.
Do you do electric keys as well, or is it all about keys now? You got out of that game before they all went electric.
I got out before it was just starting to go that way. I got out. I actually sold the company. I've done very well out of it. What I will say, because of all the idiots that made my life hell.
Yeah, welcome to my world.
I wanted to better myself. Yeah. And I wanted to do better in life than them. And that's what drove me.
Gave you a bit of a boost. Gave you a bit of a rocket.
To start my own company. I was only 21 when I started my own company.
So I'm not working with these Herberts anymore. I'm going to strike out on my own. And look at you now.
Well, I always used to bite my tongue. But there was one particular day, there was a certain guy. His nickname was Pigeon.
Okay.
And we called him that because he would do anything on anyone.
Okay.
Yeah. And... So one day, it'd been particularly, you know, harassing
me. I've got a crack on, mate. Did you chin him?
I didn't chin him. I just blew up him and I said, you know what? I said, you're 50 years old. You live in a terrible part of Cambridge. I'm going to do better than you. You watch.
I tell you what, one day he's going to get in the back of your model. He's probably not with us anymore. Good for you, mate. Lovely stuff. Cambridge Vintage Tours. 12:39 is the time. Susan's in Wolverhampton. Susan, what made you pick up the phone?
The people I worked with were, just, by and large, lovely, so it wasn't about the people at all. But I was a judge in the family court.
Oh, phone line's gone. I don't know. We'll try and get her back up. 12:39 is the time. Matt's in Dronfield. Matt, how bad is it? How bad was it? What's going on?
It was pretty bad. So I've been in the same profession for nearly 30 years now. I'm a recruiter, I was a recruiter. And in the last job I had, I won a contract, which was the largest contract the business had ever enjoyed. And it should have set me up for my retirement.
Oh, commission and everything.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, it was a big deal. And then quite simply, the directors of the business looked at the contract and thought, he's only been here 18 months. We'll take that off him. we'll divvy it up amongst everybody else who's been here a lot longer, and then we'll pull him into the boardroom and tell him to go and find another one, which was impossible.
Wow.
So I left. And it totally killed my faith in recruitment, James, to be honest, in the corporate world, definitely. And in people, in just trusting people. And completely wiped out.
I'm sorry, I'm really sorry to hear that. If that had happened early on in your career, you probably would have responded differently. But there's a sense of, what's the point? What I've put in all these years, albeit not for the same company, and...
Yep.
Why would I start again? I can't. It's Chumbawamba, isn't it? You get knocked down, you get back up again, and sometimes you just think, I'm not. I might get back up, but I'm not walking back into the same building.
You know, the sort of the fool me once type saying.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's how it felt. So I wrote a book about my life, my memoir, and that was cathartic. And then I've put headhunting to bed, and now I clean graves for a living.
So far, if you want to go on a tour in Cambridge, have your bike fixed in Brighton, or need a gravestone polishing up in Dronfield, this is the place to come.
It is indeed. It's a free ad for small businesses.
Dronfield and beyond. Is it? I mean, it's your own little business, is it? Or do you work for a council? Or if you don't mind me asking.
No, it's not my business. I saw somebody doing it on TikTok. I thought, I'm not putting a suit on again. I'm going to teach myself how to do that.
And how's business?
And I'm... It's early days.
Yeah.
So I'm advertising everywhere. I'm spamming Facebook, and I'm cleaning friends and families, you know, relatives' graves to practice on. And but it's going
to
be good.
To practice.
There's
not a lot that could go wrong, is there? I mean, you wouldn't sort of think, oh, flipping out, we got matching. Is there? Like what? What's the work? I mean, scrape off the gilt or something like that.
You scrape off the gilt, use the wrong chemicals, use anything metal.
Oh,
you lean on it.
Well, you don't want to lean on it, mate.
No, you
could end in disaster. I mean, and what's your catchment area?
I'll drive, you know, certainly in these early days, I'll drive 3-4 hours. So everywhere, really.
Well, go on, have an advert. Seriously.
Thank you, James. Well, we're only on Facebook at the moment. It's called Tender Memories.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really nice. Tender Memories.
That's really kind of you.
No, you're very kind. Good luck with it, mate. Seriously. That's quite a career change, but you'll be a lot happier. Clearly, and you know, doing something that's got a particular value to it as well. Gosh. Well, all human life is here today. Let's go back to Susan in Wolverhampton, who was a family court judge, which is a bit of a leap from a corporate headhunter turned gravestone cleaner. I think I know where we're going, Susan. Some of the stuff that you must have sat in judgment on must have been deeply harrowing.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I was used to that because I did the same work when I was a barrister. But when you're the one making the decisions, it's difficult. But really why I rang was to say that what tipped me over the edge, I've retired now, was that there was a time when I really felt that the family justice system was able to make a difference and could help families. But the services have been so eroded and removed. Social workers are so overworked. It began to feel like we weren't making any difference.
And that's heartbreaking.
And then as a judge, you're spending so much of your time trying to insist that people produce reports or do visits or make things happen, that in your heart of hearts, you know, they haven't got the capacity to do it, but you have to try and make them do it. It just becomes soul-destroying.
And so when the system was fit for purpose, you could deal with the grimness because there was light, like you were pointing people towards a light at the end of the tunnel, but the light's gone out.
Yeah. I mean, the cases were still grim, but if you felt at the end the outcome was a positive one, particularly for the children, not always positive. Not always positive for the parents, I'm afraid.
But, oh, of course.
But
oh, that's awful. I really feel for you. I hope you manage to, when you look back on things, remember all the good that you must have done.
Yeah, that's what people say when I talk to them in this. Respect, and yet you try to. Yeah,
of course
there are families. I'm sure we made a difference.
I'm sure there are as well. But the idea that I don't want to get too political, but I don't know what you're going to say in response. But when did things start? When did the rot set in? When did things start becoming untenable, unbearable for you?
Well, it's been very gradual.
Yeah. It's out of sight, out of mind, isn't it?
They just
turn down the funding and turn down the support because there's no headlines in it or there's no votes in it. And the next thing you know, the whole system's not fit for purpose.
Yeah, you know, even things like programs for perpetrators of domestic abuse.
Yeah.
In the, there's a lot in the news at the moment about abusive fathers shouldn't have contact with their children.
That's right.
If they recognise what they've done and they want to do a programme of work to change their mindset and make them better fathers so that they might be able to resume contact with their children. If there's no programme they can get on,
then there's no resumption of contact, and
you're
then
absolutely
everybody.
Stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, there are some situations where contact isn't appropriate, but
of course.
But there are fathers who could change and play a positive part in their children's lives if they had the help to change.
Oh dear. Yeah, I'm not surprised that it took a toll on you. But I understand why your friends encourage you to focus on the good stuff, because what depressed you, for want of perhaps a better word, was the stuff over which you had no control. And, you know, that is in many ways a distillation of what's most depressing, because you can say, right, well, tomorrow I will do things differently and I will feel better tomorrow. But you can't. You can't change what is going on around you, or you can change what's going on around you by changing the way that you behave. You can't change the way other people behave except by changing the way you interact. But in the context of what you describe, there's absolutely nothing you can do to make things better, which is one of the things, I think, if we were making a list, one of the really, really big things that makes a job unbearable. When your feelings have nothing to do, and they've all been themes. All the callers have had situations, having a big contract taken off you, you know, having people trying to undermine you, all of the things over which you've got no control. That is the thing that I think gives you the what I'd call the shower shivers, that sense in the shower in the morning when you're just thinking, I really can't face it today, but I know that I have to. Thank you, Susan. Do take care. It's 12:47.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
It's clear I've lost the trust of the British people. While I maintain my innocence, I now see full withdrawal from the royal family as required of me. There, Andrew. That's how you do it.
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours to I inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with
Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new. Tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
For anyone needing assistance when travelling with TfL, such as people with visual or mobility impairments, our Turn Up and Go service has staff on hand to help. It's available at all London Underground, London Overground and Elizabeth Line stations, and there's no need to book. Just turn up and go. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It's 10 to 1. Quick missing word round, I think, don't you? Just to lighten the mood slightly. You know who Hegseth is, Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of State for War now, isn't it? They've renamed it the Secretary of Department. Okay, genuine headline. Hegseth is in Japan with Donald Trump. Hegseth refuses to meet American troops with blank during South Korea trip. So the American Secretary of State for War refuses to meet American troops with blank during South Korea trip. Do you want to have a crack at that? It's a good one, this. Because, I mean, if you know, you know. If you don't know, I don't think you're going to guess. But you might guess. You might be aware of elements of the background to this story. But, you know, just yet more evidence of the weirdness that has engulfed what's left of the White House. 12:51 is the time. Back to rubbish jobs. This from Nigel, genuinely. I've had two such jobs, James. One involved, this is awful, going to branch offices to give motivational team talks when I already knew that their destiny was sealed and they would be closed down within a year or two. Some people could do that. It makes me think of the TV show, actually, The Office, and the characters who could do that easily, like David Brent, probably, and Finchie, certainly, but not the one that Martin Freeman used to play. Tim, he'd find that utterly soul-destroying. And so would I, for what it's worth. That's just going to give motivational team talks to people who you knew were already for the chop. And the second was a job I really loved until I didn't. Being criticised and undermined by other senior managers for a couple of years. Director failed to overtly support me. A new director came in to replace him. And exacerbated the problem. My performance reviews were always excellent, but it eventually broke me, and I haven't worked since. I get that. That's the attrition. On the upside, I got compensation with which I set up an animal sanctuary with which I love. Another happy ending. Bicycle repairs, gravestone cleaning, tours in Cambridge, and animal sanctuaries. You see, there is another path out there, albeit that they will all be less well paid, I think, than the jobs that people were doing before, but perhaps that's the point. Ahmed's in Brent. Ahmed, what would you like to say?
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. Can I answer the question for the...
No.
No.
Do you know it, or are you guessing?
I'm guessing based on a previous incident that happened between him and the vice president.
Yeah, go on then.
It's the beards, isn't it?
It's the beards. Yeah.
Yeah, he made a few times.
Hegseth refuses to meet American troops with beards during South Korea trip. So to which you go, what if they are the most decorated troops in the room? No, don't care. Don't care how many medals they've got. If they've got a beard, they're not coming in.
There we go.
It's all perfectly normal. Let's never forget that. What did you want to tell me?
Well, on the topic, I'm a teacher.
Yes.
And I love teaching, so I'm not changing that. Well, I haven't changed careers. I've just changed direction, if that makes sense, within teaching. But I'm calling today just for two points in particular. I've been a teacher now for almost 12 years. During the early years of my teaching, I've been appointed as a head of department. But then I found that the politics among staff, it's one of the, unfortunately, the most toxic things. So I've got colleagues who were at the age of retirement, and sadly, the law in the UK allow people to say, I am going to be retired, and you cannot ask them when they're going to be retired. So that was used by one of my colleagues as a shield for 4 years, not to take any further responsibilities or not doing anything with the students beyond the hours in the classroom because they're retiring. You can't touch that.
Okay.
And then because we have a huge shortage, and I'll call it actually a crisis in teaching recruitment, especially for my subject, they didn't have enough teachers, so the school decided, the leadership decided to draft 11 teachers from different subjects to cover the gaps in the curriculum.
Wow.
So I was working from September to December, pretty much every night until midnight, planning lessons for everybody. The two subject specialists, or they call themselves subject specialists, one is the one who was at the retirement age. The other one literally just turned around and said, like, I do not like children, so I am not doing anything extra.
That's a bit of a bit. I'd have thought, well, actually, exactly. Everyone now is thinking, like, of a teacher they had who clearly didn't like children. Well, maybe they didn't. The people I always think who don't, I'm not making light of your situation. We'll come back to it in a second. But quite often, if I go to a, like a show, you know, like a fair, a village fair, you know, like a fete or something like that.
Yeah.
And someone has been hired because they've got a mini bouncy castle or something like that. They always seem to hate children. I don't know, it's such an odd thing to do. I presume that you've got a redundancy package or something like that, and you've had a look around at businesses that you can do with the nice, manageable, flexible hours, and you make a little investment, and then and they decide, I'm going to hire a little bouncy castle, I'm going to do fetes at weekends, and then you didn't actually stop to remember that you hate children. You hate them.
Yeah.
And parents. In fact, you hate everybody. So why on earth you're in the bouncy castle business, I do not know.
I have no idea.
But you've got a pincer movement here, so you could probably have coped a little bit better with the ludicrous workload if you didn't have that colleague over there who was taking the mickey and not doing anything.
This was the mix.
Yes.
And the point I wanted to reach is actually two things. Number one, comes January, and I remember 23rd of January 2016, actually, I was rushed to hospital because my heart just had, it was not right.
Oh.
So I was in A&E, laying on the table, the cardiologist doing all the tests. I had a couple of, angiograms.
Yeah.
Because they keep thinking that I'm having a heart attack. But then later on, and I kid you not, I'm laying down there. I remember this about 2:30 in the morning. And the cardiologist came and said, let me guess, are you a teacher?
No.
I kid you not. I said, yes. Like, do you know what's going on? Whatever's happening in the educational system, it is not right. This is 23rd of January. He said, there's been about 36 of you on this very table down in this hospital. And sadly, two of you have passed away of pretty much the same symptoms under the age of 35.
Just complete stress. Complete stress.
But see, this is the thing. There is this condition that mainly hits men under the age of 40. I was under 40 back then. Mm. It's called myocarditis. And it is inflammation to the heart muscle. It reads as a heart attack, but actually, it is like a normal, if you have a normal infection in your throat, but it finds its way to your heart as a result of stress.
Well, I'm obviously not medically qualified, but I've got no reason to doubt what you're telling us. Let's take that as a warning, and the likelihood of it happening to teachers being so high is yet another cause for national shame. Ahmed, thank you. I know you stayed in the profession. I'm glad that the circumstances you're working in now are obviously much better. We may have stumbled accidentally across another topic, because Chris points out that he's always amazed by how many ice cream van people also seem to hate children and the general public. Not Enzo, my mate Enzo, who has an ice cream van that can, I don't think he'll be there now because it's winter, but he's usually outside Hillier's Garden Centre in Osterley, Isleworth. Where is it? Sion House, you know where I mean, near Kew Gardens, other side of the river from Kew Gardens. Enzo's a legend. He's one of those ice cream men that should be in a kind of TV show. He's so full of joy and happiness. But you're right, sometimes they're right misery gets. I think we're out of time. Maria in Newcastle, I do apologise. Bertie in Weybridge, Nicola in Bromley, Nick in Woodford, Robin in Murfield. We may return to this territory again. Thank you for that. Sometimes it's a little bit overambitious of me to think that we can do the light and the dark in the same hour, because if you listen to two calls that are from the serious end of the spectrum, then you're less likely to ring in with a call from the light end. But I think we covered all the bases there. That was lovely, and I didn't even tell you about my years in telesales. I'll have to save that for another day, and the time Interpol came into the office. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts, including Full Disclosure, which features Charles Dance this week, one of my all-time favourites, and James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from this show every day. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Swarbrick will be back at 4, but now on LBC, it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. The storm in Jamaica we're keeping a very close eye on. We'll bring you regular reports on that. But at 3, if a group openly announced it was coming to your neighbourhood to launch a crusade, quotes, and reclaim, quotes, the area that you live in, what would you do? At 2, two military sites in Inverness and East Sussex are being earmarked for asylum seekers currently living in hotels. Remember that £15 billion hotel bill we talked about yesterday? One Army veteran joins me to tell us why government should do more for them. But I'm going to start with Prince Andrew, the royal family, the king being heckled. And remember the heckle at the Queen's funeral procession in Edinburgh? I'd momentarily forgotten about that one. Something has to change here, doesn't it?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the world's strongest storm of the year is closing in on Jamaica with warnings of catastrophic and life-threatening conditions. Hurricane Melissa is expected to bring 4 metre waves and winds of up to 175 miles per hour when it makes landfall. British tourist Aaron Asomdwe decided not to try and get a flight back home. He says officials have prepared well for what's to come.
We made a decision to stay because the way that the hotel staff were handling the situation definitely made us feel at ease and secure. So we decided to extend our stay as opposed to traveling throughout the island where we wouldn't be too sure about how the roads would be. We've just sat down with all the hotel residents and staff and had a really good meeting and walk around the hotel, which definitely, I believe, put a lot of us at ease in regards to what's to come.
A government minister has told LBC that further MOD sites are being identified to house asylum seekers rather than hotels. Two barracks in Inverness and East Sussex have so far been picked out to house about 900 men. A parliamentary committee has branded the current system failed, chaotic and expensive. Tory frontbencher Alex Burghardt has told LBC the latest idea is a huge admission of failure.
The fact is that the government has totally failed to deter people from crossing the channel, and consequently they now need very large accommodation centres in order to house them. And the truth is, when Keir Starmer became Prime Minister, we left behind the Rwanda deal, which had been taken a lot of work, a lot of effort, and took several attempts to make work. But it was, by the time we left office, it was ready, and the first thing he did was scrap it.
Rachel Reeves is understood to be facing a larger than expected gap in the public finances ahead of her budget next month. The additional shortfall of £20 billion is reportedly the result of productivity levels being downgraded in official forecasts. The Treasury has declined to comment. Amazon has confirmed it's reducing its corporate workforce by about 14,000 jobs worldwide. The mass redundancies are part of efforts to step up the use of artificial intelligence. And Fawlty Towers actress Prunella Scales has died at the age of 93. The actress died peacefully at home in London yesterday. She'd been diagnosed with vascular dementia in 2013. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 34 points at 96.87. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather, scattered showers in the north this afternoon, cloudy and wetter in northern Scotland, mostly dry with sunny spells and the odd shower elsewhere, a high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. We'll be keeping a close eye throughout the afternoon on this dreadful storm in Jamaica, already claimed several lives and people really hunkering down to try to survive it, in truth. So we'll keep a close eye on that and bring you a couple of reports about it. But I want to start our conversation this afternoon with the royal family and Prince Andrew. It seems to me that, not for the first time actually, a real tipping point has been reached. And again, so far, all those tipping points have been either not responded to at all or responded to in a way that doesn't actually fully resolve the problem for the royal family. And the problem for the royal family, it seems to me, is if these allegations hanging over Prince Andrew and his response to them, and the most recent development is the Virginia Giuffre book, isn't it? If they are materially changing people's trust in the royal family, then that is a problem. And it's something that the royal family has to address and has to really, honestly, frankly, look at. Prince Andrew is the king's brother, as well as being Prince Andrew and a member of the royal family. So there is, I guess, there's that complication. But they're used to that complication as a family. They know they have a very public facing mode, and they have inevitably a private mode, some of which we know about, most of which I'm sure we don't know about, nor should we really, particularly in terms of their relationships. But it seems to me they are really missing the moments when it is a tipping point, and I think this is one such moment. I'll tell you in a minute or two how I think they and he should respond to this. I actually don't think it's that complicated anymore, if it ever was, but I certainly don't think it's complicated. Emotionally, maybe, for them, yes, but in terms of the job that needs to be done, not. Here's the moment that the King, King Charles, was heckled about this outside Lichfield Cathedral yesterday.
How long have you known about Andrew and X stage? Have you asked the police to cover up for Andrew? What do you think should be allowed to say to lawyers in the House of Commons?
How long have you known about Prince Andrew and Epstein? Have you asked the police for a cover-up for your brother? I mean, those are questions that I guess any self-respecting journalist who got the chance to sit down with the King and interview him, which they weren't, would be throwing at the King, would be putting to the King. And he knows it. And the people around him know it. And Prince Andrew knows it as well. The heckler who was shouted at by a few of the people around him, was ignored by the King, that's their mode, is just to keep going, spoke with Nick Ferrari anonymously this morning to explain why he did it.
It often feels that during visits by the royals, quite important issues or controversies are pushed aside or swept under the rug. And by bringing the issue back into the public eye in such a public manner, it sort of highlights these core problems facing the monarchy at a time when they're trying to sort of push it aside in favour of focusing on the grandeur of the event. I didn't necessarily expect to hear answers, but my main goal with it was to once again push the issue into the public spotlight, because it is very important that people are talking about the issue of Andrew's gross misconduct and also his corruption in public office. So even while I did not expect a direct response from the King, there has been a response publicly, with people now discussing the issue and it being a focus. I think what is needed is a full-scale royal inquiry into both the prince and his connections to, of course, Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted sex offender. And I think the main issue at hand is just the inquiry is needed mostly because of just to show respect for the victims.
I think you can hear in that gentleman's voice that he sincerely holds those views, and I'm sure many of you share them. I'd really be keen to get a sense of how many of you share them. And whether you think, the reason I'm asking you this is I think this is the absolutely fundamental question for the King now, and for the you know, the people, the officials around the King. To what degree are you now associating Andrew's behaviour, and again, important to say he denies any criminality, but Andrew's behaviour with the King, your respect for the King, your respect for the royal family, your interest in that whole arrangement being maintained, to what degree is it turning you away from the royal family? Because there's no doubt about it that, you know, there's the constitutional elements and all of that, but the bond and the binding thing with the royal family and the public is about liking them and trusting them and being interested in them in a good way, in a healthy way, in a, you know what I mean, in a fun way kind of thing. It's all of those things. It's being pleased when you see a royal wedding. It's that kind of stuff. And this is the polar opposite of that. And you'll remember even...